Coming up next on 5 Live.
The Bank of England hints that interest rates could rise sooner than expected, perhaps even by the end of the year. The Football World Cup kicks off in Brazil, with Brazil beating Croatia 3-1, though the protests are continuing. And it's our health and fitness phone-in, where we'll be asking, what's the best way to exercise and keep fit in the sweltering summer heat?
This is BBC 5 Live, the home of Brazil 2014.
It's 1 o'clock on 5 Live as we welcome local radio stations from across the BBC. This is Up All Night. I'm Ian Lee.
The main news on 5 Live, President Obama says Iraq needs help to overcome Islamist militants. And in sport, Brazil get the World Cup underway with a 3-1 win over Croatia.
On 5 Live today from 1:30, you can hear Rio Report with Mark Chapman. At 5, you can hear live World Cup commentary of Mexico against Cameroon. At 8, it's current World Cup holders Spain against Netherlands. And 11, Chile against Australia. Now with the news, it's Madeline Briggs. Good morning, this is Ian Lee, up all night, 6 minutes past one on 5 Live. Coming up, the World Cup has officially started. Well, what did you make of the opening ceremony? Trees on stilts and children with balls tied to their legs seem to be the order of the day, along with a performance by J-Lo that many suspect had the same sound guy as the one who worked on Jamaica Inn. But what of the football? Was the opening match any good? We'll hear from our reporters who are in Brazil now. But before we talk football, another big story of the day is Iraq, and President Obama says that the United States is examining all options to stop Islamist insurgents heading for the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. The Iraqi government has deployed its air force to attack the jihadists from the al-Qaeda-linked ISIS group, but its militants still control the cities of Tikrit and Mosul and are now fighting for control of large swathes of the country. Some US citizens in Iraq are being temporarily relocated by their companies. Well, Patrick Coburn is the Independent newspaper's Iraq correspondent. I asked him first to explain what's been happening on the ground in northern Iraq today.
The Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, this extreme outfit which has conquered much of northern Iraq, continues to advance. They avowed that they're going to take Baghdad and then move on the Shia cities of the south. They say that their own victories can only be explained by divine intervention. They don't show any sign of stopping.
Who are ISIS, and what exactly do they want? Do they want to take over all of Iraq?
Yes, ISIS grew out of al-Qaeda in Iraq, which has fought the Americans, but above all fought the Shia. It's an extremely bigoted organization. It believes in fundamentalist Islam, which means Sharia law. It means the subjugation of women. It means that heretics, Christians and Shia and anybody who differs from them is regarded as a heretic. Their method of responding to almost anything is violence.
The militants have seized the cities of Mosul and Tikrit, and they already have western cities like Ramadi. But what exactly does that mean? How much of the country do they control?
They probably control around 15%. That doesn't mean a lot because Iraqis tend to be concentrated in cities on the rivers, on the Euphrates and Tigris. They're big areas of salt marsh and desert. But they've taken two big cities, Mosul and Tikrit. They've moved into others. But what's so extraordinary about the present situation is that the Iraqi government had 900,000 men under arms, one of the bigger armies in the world. They had $100 billion a year in oil revenue to arm these soldiers. And this whole army has sort of evaporated and fled before forces that are much weaker than itself.
Why have they done that? Because there are only a few thousand of these militants, and you say that it's a huge Iraqi army, and yet they seem to have just put down their guns and run away.
Well, I can give you various reasons, but I'm still amazed by it. I mean, it's enormous. It's a kind of patronage machine. In other words, it was sort of jobs for the boys. Particularly if you were a Shia and you wanted a job, you joined the army. You certainly drew a salary. There may have been 900,000 jobs, but I don't know how many of them ever actually turned up. many of the, some of the units that were fighting in Anbar, one of the Sunni provinces earlier in the year, people were complaining that there were meant to be 700 men in a unit, and only there were only about 150. They were complaining that money for food and fuel was all embezzled by the officers. If you wanted to become a divisional commander, it could cost you maybe a couple of million dollars. And then you'd make that back through protection rackets and kickbacks from the checkpoints on the roads, who would extort money from vehicles and cars and trucks going past.
It's interesting that the national parliaments failed to vote on declaring a state of emergency, which is what the Prime Minister had asked for. Why did that happen?
I think complete distrust in him, in Nouri al-Maliki, the Prime Minister. But also it's sort of absurd because, you know, the problem is not that he doesn't have enough powers, but his soldiers are tearing off their uniforms, throwing down their weapons and running away. You know, this demand for more powers is really a sort of bit of a smokescreen to suggest that he didn't have enough power to stop this happening. But in a sense, he's had too much power. One of the reasons that a small fanatical group like ISIS has been so successful is that they come from the Sunni community. About 20% of Iraqis are Sunni, concentrated in the north and center. And these people, since the fall of Saddam Hussein, have been treated as second-class citizens. They've been marginalized politically and economically. If you're a Sunni young man, you're always frightened of being picked up by the police, tortured, maybe forced to confess to things you didn't do, thrown in jail for a long time, even if you're found innocent. Often people don't get out of jail because you have to bribe an officer, often with a lot of money, maybe $40,000, to actually sign the piece of paper which releases you from the prison, although a court has found you innocent. So you can imagine these pretty people are pretty angry, and this has been very fertile ground for ISIS to recruit, or at least for people to feel that ISIS may not be great, but at least it's better than the Iraqi government.
ISIS are heading to Baghdad. Have they got any realistic hope of taking Baghdad?
I'd have thought not, because it's a predominantly Shia city. The Iraqi army may have failed, but I mean, some of its better units are concentrated around the capital. The Shia have powerful militias that are now rearming, that certainly will fight and not retreat. So I would have thought not. But ISIS itself today is putting out statements saying, you know, oh, we're winning, we're going on to Baghdad, only, you know, God has decided we will win, otherwise how have we been so successful? And don't give the other side a chance, this is the phrase, to get their breath back. Attack now while they're still demoralized and on the run.
How could this affect the wider region in general, and in particular Iran?
Well, it affects Iran enormously because Iran cares more about Iraq, which is 60% Shia, as is Iran, than it does even about Syria or any other country. That there was a long rivalry with the Americans about who should be the predominant influence in Iran, in Iraq, which the Iranians won. And now they see this all sort of breaking up in their hands. And they also said they not only don't want their fellow Shia to be defeated, I think they'd also be extremely nervous about a fanatical Shia-hating group like ISIS taking over a large chunk of Iraq. Now, what will they do about it? Well, they could activate various Shia militias, which are under their control, and give them support to stop the other ISIS and counterattack. They could do what they can for the Iraqi government. But it's difficult to know to what to do with an army which just sort of disintegrates. I wonder if they will support the Iraqi prime minister any longer. I mean, they may feel that he's responsible for this defeat and remove their support for him. I rather doubt if they're going to cross the frontier with troops, with helicopters or aircraft. It's not quite in the Iranian style. They tend to do things at one remove.
And what about the Americans? What options do they have? Because it could be argued that the part of this problem has happened because the Americans have got no presence there at all anymore.
Yeah, but the Iraqis didn't want them to have any presence. I mean, this is being brought up now as if this was something that, you know, Obama had withdrawn. But he withdrew because they couldn't agree with the Iraqi government to have anybody remaining there. And, you know, they negotiated for quite a long time. It's not that this sort of happened by accident or it was all a decision taken in the White House. But it's also difficult, you know, what exactly would the Americans do? Training? Well, you know, that hasn't worked too well, looking at the Iraqi army. It's a toxic idea in America to intervene in Iraq or Syria. Obviously, the American people don't want it. And the only thing probably would do any good would be providing air cover to the Iraqi army.
Do you think that's a possibility, drone strikes, things like that?
Not really, no. I don't think it would make much difference unless it was an absolutely massive intervention, and I don't feel that that's politically possible.
And this situation, is it going to get worse, or do you think ultimately it will burn itself out? Because it is a limited number of ISIS members, isn't it? It's not huge.
Yeah, but nothing succeeds like success. You know, a lot of Sunni young men who've been groaning under this sort of oppression by the Shia government will be saying, now, you know, who freed us from this? It was ISIS. You know, these guys have got something going for them. So I don't think they'll have much difficulty in recruiting people. It's a strange organization. You know, it's extremely fanatical. It's completely bigoted. It's extremely cruel. It puts out videos of shooting its enemies in the back of the head. I mean, just Shia lorry drivers picked up on the road. But at the same time, it's very tightly disciplined, controlled from the top. And that shows great military expertise. I think a lot of former officers from Saddam's regime are involved in its military planning, which is pretty meticulous.
Well, that was Patrick Coburn, the Independent Newspaper's Iraq correspondent. I'm joined now by James Jeffrey, who was US ambassador in Iraq after the elections in 2010 and 2012. Thanks for joining us, Ambassador. What are the United States military options here?
They are some, and President Obama in his statements today clearly is weighing very carefully what he will do. There are two problems. There is the underlying problem that we heard the discussion about involving the unity of Iraq, not just between the Sunni Kurds, the Sunni Arabs and the Shia Arabs, but also the Kurds in the north. That's been a longstanding problem, and that will not be resolved very quickly. The second problem we have, as you just heard, is essentially an offensive operation by a motorized force, not large, but highly experienced, very successful, and pretty well equipped of these ISIL terrorists. Their goal is not only to seize most of the Sunni Arab lands of Iraq. They've already achieved that, and that's going to be very hard to get them out of there. But what they're trying to do now, almost certainly, is to encircle Baghdad and cut it off from the supplies the 6 million strong city needs to live. Fuel, water, food, munitions, other supplies. It's largely a Shia city. It cannot fall to these people. And the Shia troops who fled Mosul and other Sunni Arab areas clearly will do better in Baghdad. But nonetheless, because the city is surrounded almost entirely by Sunni enclaves where ISIL can operate, there is a real risk that they will essentially establish a siege. That will produce almost certainly an Iranian intervention in the south, and quite possibly a de facto or even de jure Kurdish breaking off from Iraq. That's a disaster for the whole Middle East and will suck in more powers in what would be the biggest war in the region in decades. Thus, the key thing is to keep Iran out, keep the Turks in, and keep ISIS under pressure. And the only force that can do that is U.S. air power.
So it's air power. So sorry to interrupt, Ambassador. It's air power. Is it? It's drone strikes. It's deploying U.S. aircraft.
Well, it's exactly what we did in Bosnia. We then did it in Kosovo, and we then did it in Libya. It's providing air power that is devastating against troops, particularly motorized troops in the open, and this is open terrain, much of it, and serves to buttress the forces who are fighting with us on the ground. It has a tremendous morale factor, and this is exactly what the Iraqis need. The ragtag Libyan forces were no match for Gaddafi's army until U.S. and other NATO aircraft chewed up his armored columns as they moved to Benghazi. The same thing happened with the Serbs in Bosnia and then in Kosovo. It's a combination of other people's boots on the ground, because we're not going to do it, and American air power, which can be done at low cost and low risk.
What's gone wrong with the Iraqi defense forces? The U.S. has spent billions of dollars training them and equipping them, and they're not really doing a lot, are they? In some cases, they're just turning and running.
Well, first of all, we've seen Iraqi forces turn and run before. 1991 in Kuwait, and then in 2003. It's very hard to motivate a pay-for-hire mass military force unless you've got extraordinarily high standards of leadership and training, and the Iraqi army does not have that. While the Americans were present, one of the major efforts of the American army was to nurture and to coach Iraqi forces, and we did a pretty good job of it, but we haven't been able to do this for 2.5 years. And at the same time, relatively good leaders have been replaced with people who are essentially loyal to Maliki and to his cronies. And these people are, for many reasons, not the best of officers. They don't lead from the front. So that's what you have, is bad leadership and an unmotivated force that is then put into an area of Iraq, the Sunni Arab areas, where these people are hated as sectarian Shia, who parade around with their black Mada Ali and Mada Hussein flags, which are the saints of the Shia religion. And this is seen as an affront to the Sunnis. I've seen this myself.
The U.S. pulled its troops out of Iraq at the end of 2011. In retrospect, did it withdraw too quickly, do you think?
Well, first of all, here's the facts. George Bush agreed in 2008 to pull all troops out by 2011. By 2011, there was almost no combat in Iraq other than a rump group of al-Qaeda, from whence we now have this ISIL. But at the time, all they could do was occasional suicide bombings. So there was no violence. There was no real threat to the Iraqi security forces, which were more than 500,000 strong. And therefore, there was not all of that much desire to have the American forces. Most Iraqis, other than Muqtada al-Sadr's party, agreed that Americans could stay, but they would not sign off on legal immunity, and that's the requirement that America has for putting its troops on the ground anywhere in the world. So it was a question of the legal status of the Americans, not whether they should stay or not. And based upon that, we decided, regretfully, that we wouldn't stay on. Looking back, this was a mistake.
And you think that if U.S. troops had stayed there, we wouldn't be in this situation we're in now?
Well, again, if U.S. troops had stayed there, I'll tell you what would happen. First of all, they wouldn't be fighting on the ground because we weren't planning on having many troops and that kind of troops. What they would have done was the counterterrorism mission, and we're the best in the world in that, with fusion cells with the Iraqis, doing intelligence exchange. Secondly, we would have F-16s there. That was part of the plan. And, of course, you can ramp up aircraft very, very easily if you've got a base to have them in. Thirdly, we would have been able to train the Iraqi forces, and this is what we were doing in 2010 and 2011, in what's known as platoon, company, and battalion-level combat training. This is live fire and maneuver. This is facing tactical situations. This is moving around in the countryside and not getting lost. This is exactly what the Iraqi army can't do, and they're up against the ISIL, who have been trained and hardened by years of fighting against the Syrian army. So we would have done those three things. The fourth thing, and this is psychological, but it's very important, when there are American troops on the ground in a combat, such dangerous combat situation, regardless of how few, the entire American bureaucracy mobilizes differently to ensure that that mission is important, that mission will be resourced, that mission will have a linear, strong chain of command, and the president and everybody is behind them. Once they left, we tried to do this through the embassy and liaison teams and military assistance and such, and we weren't as successful, to be honest.
James Jeffrey, former U.S. ambassador in Iraq, I appreciate your time this morning. Thank you very much. It's 1:23. Now, the Football World Cup has begun in Brazil with a very lavish opening ceremony in Sao Paulo.
Welcome to Sao Paulo. Welcome to the World Cup on 5 Live, the home of Brazil 2014. Put your flags
up in the air. The protagonists are making their way onto the pitch, which is a brightly coloured carpet. There is also in the central part of it what they call the flag of happiness. And right in the middle of that, there is a huge black ball. Now, it appears black at the moment, but it's actually an LED ball. So it'll spring into life as well. And that is the centre point of the opening ceremony, which is effectively split into four chapters, which are nature, the diversity of the people, the football, and then, rather cryptically, the reveal. One world, one fight. The LED ball has burst into colourful light, and this happiness flag is being pulled away. It's your world, my world, our world today. And we are almost into the fourth and final chapter of this extremely colourful opening ceremony. And we currently have a Brazilian flag which has been walked towards the LED ball, which is still flashing away there in the middle. The football section of this opening ceremony is just coming to an end, and 32 teams are represented by 64 children. There's just one girl down there, young Isabella, but she's been given a very much a starring role in all of this. She's right at the front of the whole thing. And in a moment or two, we're going to have a symbolic kickoff for this World Cup. It's your world, my world, our world today. And we invite the whole world to play. El mundo, tu mundo. And now we're seeing what we would call the reveal here, because underneath that Brazilian flag was none other than the performers of the official World Cup song. So Jennifer Lopez is there, Pitbull is there, the Brazilian singer Claudio Leite is there, and the percussion band Olodum. And here we are now seeing Jennifer Lopez herself being revealed as the ball peels open.
Jenny.
Well, that was the opening ceremony. Very lavish, very exciting, very loud. The build-up, though, has been overshadowed by protests against the huge cost, as well as controversy over alleged corruption in football's world governing body, FIFA. Tonight, there were clashes between police and protesters on the world-famous Copacabana beach, as Tim Vickery told me earlier.
Well, there are clashes, or certainly the potential for clashes, out there between a group of protesters and the police, the group of protesters in the vicinity of the TV studios, and the police have prevented them from storming those TV studios. You can probably hear the helicopters in the background at the moment, and it's yet more examples of perhaps the public relations disaster that this 2014 World Cup is, with a significant proportion of Brazilian society.
Any idea on numbers? How many protesters and how many police are there?
No, although I think that we can make a comparison with last year during the Confederations Cup, which is the test event for the World Cup held a year earlier, where this protest movement flared up. No one really saw it coming, not even the original organisers of the protests. We had Brazilians taking to the streets in their tens of thousands, huge, huge crowds. At the moment, around the country, the protests in some cases are violent, but they seem to be limited to a kind of core of activists. Now, one of the key questions is, will these protests catch on among the less politicized Brazilians in the way that they did last year? And that, I think, will be a very, very important question for the smooth running of the tournament.
What are they protesting about, Tim? What do they want?
Well, this started off almost as internet protests, which means that almost everyone had his or her own protest. People were making their own banners and taking them to the streets. Obviously, the crux of the matter is the public spending on the 2014 World Cup and the feeling in society that the Brazilian citizens are paying too much for this tournament and not getting back enough in return. But there are other, I think, deeper things also going on. One thing is, many of these people are kind of new middle class. Some of them have travelled for the first time, and they've gone abroad, and people have said, "Ah, you're Brazilian. Ah, Pelé, carnival, yeah, football, yes, yeah, samba." And they've said, "Well, you know, I'm not really into these things, to be honest. These things don't really represent me. They might be a part of my culture, but there are so many other things." And I think this is an absolutely fascinating dynamic. We are dealing with a society which has made, and I've been living here for 20 years, and it's made considerable progress in that time, but it's still a society which is marked by huge differences in income and in life opportunities. And this image that the world has of of Brazil and Brazilians as happy, dancing, almost to the point of childlike idiocy at times. Who historically has concocted this image? Well, clearly it's been those at the top of the tree. And if you are, and for many years Brazil has been ruled by authoritarian governments, if you are an authoritarian government, or if you are a government presiding over huge differences in income, it's clearly in your interest to promote the image of a country of happy people. And one thing, I think people are learning so much more about Brazil. It's a huge country. Perhaps the most intelligent thing ever said about this country was said by Tom Jobim, the great bossa nova musician. He said, "Brazil is not for beginners." It's such a wonderful, wonderful phrase because it's so appropriate. Everything you think about this country, everything you think you know, you can find evidence for the contrary. And over the next few weeks, the world is getting a vision of this country. After 20 years, you know, I've arrived at the conclusion that the only really mature possible relationship with this country is one of love and hate. It's a love-hate relationship. And I think over the next few weeks, the world will have deeper reasons to love Brazil, but perhaps deeper reasons to hate it as well.
Well, that was Up All Night's Tim Vickery in Rio speaking to me earlier on. There have also been protests in Sao Paulo. Let's talk now to our sports news correspondent there, Richard Conway. Richard, are the protests still going on?
Well, what I've seen this evening, I haven't seen anything in Sao Paulo itself. That being said, there have been reports of skirmishes in Rio tonight, rocks being thrown at one of the TV studios that is near Copacabana Beach, is what I understand from reports. But from just driving through the center of Sao Paulo tonight, it does appear to be calm, but that certainly wasn't the case this morning. And early this afternoon, I was out near the subway station in the east of the city, near to the stadium, area called Cará, where the a small group of protesters, it was around about 200, 250 in number, gathered to stage a protest. Within minutes of that getting underway, it was peaceful. The police went straight in. There were stun grenades, tear gas, rubber bullets, and they pursued the protesters up the street, and that sparked a series of running skirmishes throughout the day through those streets, and with police taking absolutely no chances at all in terms of a risk of the protesters trying to get to the stadium and making it a disturbance around the stadium tonight. No chance taken whatsoever with that.
Do we know if there were injuries, if there were arrests?
We understand there are around 31 people arrested today, 4 injuries. Two journalists we know of, a journalist from CNN that we definitely know of, were injured, perhaps not seriously, hit by a gas canister, we understand. Police, we did see picking protesters out of the group, chasing them down the street, making those arrests, and then taking people away. There was a desire today that the game should go off, without incident. We saw those images in the Confederations Cup last summer, where there were large-scale protests which took place in several cities. And, of course, it wasn't just Sao Paulo that was affected today. We've seen protests in a number of cities, Belo Horizonte, in Rio as well, and, of course, here in Sao Paulo. So this is perhaps going to be a running theme throughout this World Cup, that anger that many of those protesters feel because of the opportunity cost of that, as they see it, of staging this World Cup, and the opportunity cost of a lack of investment in health and in education and in welfare. That is not going to be dissipated by these games getting underway. They may love football. They certainly don't like the spending that has been put into staging this World Cup.
Richard Conway in Sao Paulo, thank you very much. And in case you forgot, there is actually a football tournament taking place. It's called the World Cup. We'll talk a little bit later on about the Brazil-Croatia match. It's 1:33. Let's get the news now with Madeline Briggs.
On digital, online, smartphone and tablet. This is BBC Five Live.
It's 1:39, Up All Night. I'm Ian Lee on Five Live. The Governor of the Bank of England has signalled that interest rates could rise much sooner than expected, perhaps even by the end of this year. It's Mark Carney's strongest hint yet that rates could rise for the first time in more than 5 years from their historic low of 0.5%. Delivering the annual Mansion House speech tonight, the Governor said that growth had been faster than expected.
there's already great speculation about the exact timing of the first rate hike, and this decision is becoming more balanced. It could happen sooner than financial markets currently expect.
Well, our reporter Philip Hampshire spent the evening at Mansion House.
Yes, indeed. We have the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Mr. George Osborne, also the Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, give out different speeches for how they see the economy going, what they see as being particularly important for the business environment, and basically discussing things with some of the most important people in London and in the United Kingdom as a whole.
Now, Mark Carney's hinting at a rise in interest rates, isn't he? Why is that?
Well, there's a lot of concern that's been aired over the course of the day, but particularly based around these speeches. All of it has been pegged to George Osborne's speech about the housing market and the strength of the UK economy. And they have a very difficult task ahead of them, because obviously with the housing market roaring away, particularly down in the southeast of the UK, that's promoting a good amount of economic growth. At the same time that they've got that going on, unemployment hasn't been coming down quite as quickly as they've been looking for. So Mark Carney has been holding off on raising interest rates, and basically this evening he's chosen to highlight the fact that he may have to put up interest rates a little bit quicker than everyone had previously been anticipating. In some senses, that may be a good thing. He's saying the economy is doing reasonably well.
What impact would a rise in interest rates have on ordinary people?
Well, the most prominent way that interest rates affect your average person in the street, of course, is if they've got a mortgage. Anyone who doesn't have a fixed-rate mortgage would then see Bank of England put up its rate. This would filter through to the banks would then put up their interest rates, and by far the biggest component that would have for the average person is they'd have to start paying more every month for their mortgage. For other people, though, there are still impacts. If you're a saver, then you might actually be quite pleased about this. Savings rates have been really quite terrible for the majority of people over the last few years, and so they might actually see a little bit of a boost.
George Osborne also spoke tonight about fears of a bubble in the housing market. What did he have to say about that?
Well, essentially, London house prices have been rising very quickly, around about 17% in the course of the last year, and that's created a little bit of concern on several fronts. Firstly, the rest of the UK hasn't been growing anything like that quickly, and so people have been saying, is this a bubble? Now, in addition to that, in order to afford these houses that are getting ever more expensive, and flats, of course, in some cases have been getting ever more expensive, people have been having to borrow ever larger amounts from their banks. Whereas you might typically, 20 years ago, borrow 3.5 times your income, people have now been going to 5 and 6 times their income. And what he's announced today is that part of the Bank of England will be set up specifically to clamp down on large multiples being lent out to different people.
Well, that was our reporter, Philip Hampshire, at Mansion House, sounding very much like he's in the kitchen at Mansion House. I'm not quite sure if they'd let him into the main building. Now, for the latest news from Nigeria with the Lagos-based journalist Chris Iwoka, I asked him first about reports of a ban on public screenings of football matches in the north of the country.
In fact, as we speak, yes, in northern Nigeria, especially in the state of Adamawa, where there was an attack not too long ago in a pub, a drinking pub, which was screening a football match. And there are fears that the insurgents in the northeast of Nigeria, Boko Haram, might use the opportunity of the current World Cup to target some viewing centers. Of course, this will not be the first time they had targeted that of Adamawa. And again, they also targeted another one in Jos, but it was a suicide bomb attack that was foiled. Now, the fear in the heart of the government, especially the security agencies, is that the Boko Haram might just target a crowd of people, because they consider that viewing centers also sell alcohol, and this they feel is against Islam. But beyond that, there have been a lot of attacks in recent times. In Jos, in central Nigeria, there have been attacks where at least 8 people were killed. There have been other attacks in several other parts of the northeast, especially some villages in Borno area. And the World Cup now on, and Nigeria being a great footballing nation, and indeed lots of football fans all over the country. Nigeria is also participating in the World Cup anyway. And so the expectation that a lot of people will crowd into these viewing centers. And so to forestall any possibility of an attack on such centers, the ban has to be put in place by the state agencies.
And as you say, Nigeria, it loves football. How are people reacting to that?
Well, it dampens a lot of spirit. People are really not happy about it. But again, it appears that they are taking it with some sense of responsibility, as people are now feeling that they need to also take responsibility for their own security. And so they have to be cautious where they gather or where they go. Of course, next Monday, Nigeria will be playing its first match against Iran. And a lot of people are expecting to meet with friends in a viewing center or possibly a pub, a drinking pub, where over glasses of wine, they could be watching and commenting on the game. But again, with the security situation in the country, it's not going to, it appears the luxury of that conviviality of comradeship of friends watching football together may not be there, and many people are really not happy about it.
Well, yeah, that would be a great shame to miss out on that. Still on insecurity, Hollywood star Angelina Jolie and British Foreign Secretary William Hague are holding a summit on ending sexual violence in war. Over 200 schoolgirls, of course, abducted from Chibok in northeast Nigeria, yet to be released, and there are indications that they may be raped.
In fact, that is the dark cloud hanging over Nigeria as it is right now. The Chibok girls, about 200 of them, are still in custody of the abductors of Boko Haram somewhere in the northeast of Nigeria and have not been released. And at the meeting in London, there had been another meeting at the verge, at the sidelines, according to the reports, hosted by the Foreign Secretary, William Hague, with foreign ministers of not just Nigeria, but Cameroon, Niger, Mali, and Benin Republic over this issue of Boko Haram. The issue of Boko Haram attack as well as sexual violence is something that has echoed, especially for those that have fought wars. And Nigeria currently, according to the president, said Nigeria is in a state of war with Boko Haram. So the fears that these Boko Haram members may, now having this over 200 schoolgirls between age 14 and 16 in their custody and could subject them to some form of rape, is very, very strong here. And the government, although said everything is being done to rescue them, what I can say is that there had been a lot of protests going on urging the government to do something to rescue the girls. But up till now, the efforts of the government is yet to see the light of day. And this is, again, part of the effect of the ongoing insurgency by members of the Boko Haram that has also killed lots of people, not just in the northeast of Nigeria, but also attacked Abuja, the capital of Nigeria.
That was Chris Iwoka in Lagos. It's 1:47.
Across the UK.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live. Up all night.
Now, as we've been hearing, there have been protests in several cities in Brazil about the cost of the World Cup, but that didn't stop the first match going on. Here's a reminder of what happened between Brazil and Croatia.
And Brazil are heading to victory here.
So Brazil have won the opening match of the Football World Cup in Sao Paulo, beating Croatia 3-1. Five Live's Conor McNamara has watched the game in Rio.
I guess that there is a huge amount of pressure on Brazil, and you sort of, you know, you could see the emotion in the players as they came out the tunnel at the start and they lined up for the anthems. And, you know, they've been waiting for this for a long, long time. They've known that they'd be the host. They know that they would have the centre stage of the world football looking at them and the pressure of the country on them. And I guess when you look at it in those terms, it's no surprise that Brazil got off to a little bit of a shaky start. But don't forget, 4 years ago, Spain lost their opening game and went on to win the World Cup. So for Brazil, it's not been that bad tonight. They recovered. I think they were helped out quite considerably by a refereeing decision in their favour. But they've got that first win underway, and I bet you we will see them now in a more relaxed fashion when they play their next game.
They had a couple of referee decisions go their own way. A yellow card was presented when perhaps the player could have been sent off, and of course they had that controversial penalty.
Yeah, the penalty particularly is the one that's going to be highlighted around the world. And this is the trouble when you do have the spotlight in the world. You know, these things will be noticed. The referee's from Japan. He has been involved in World Cups before. And I know that, you know, there was comments earlier on this season in with Manchester City in the Champions League. And Manuel Pellegrini was not pleased that a referee from Sweden was taking charge of a Champions League game, saying that the quality of football that he's in charge in week in, week out in the Swedish league wouldn't be up to Champions League standard. I think the Croatians will have a similar sort of comment to make about domestic football in Japan, and are the referees used to making the big decisions?
Brazil obviously won. Neymar had a great game, stole the show, but they weren't as strong and as confident and as fluid as when they were playing in the Confederations Cup last year, were they?
Well, no, as I said in the first answer, I think it's the pressure of hosting your World Cup. I mean, they've known about this for a long, long time now. And, you know, some of these guys, since they've been teenagers, they'll have had, you know, an ambition to be involved in this World Cup and to represent Brazil. And that has to bring a huge amount of pressure with it. I think Brazil finished the game much more strongly than they started. I think once they get into their second, third matches of the tournament, that's perhaps when we'll see them at their best. But, you know, if you're going to rate them against the top teams that we've seen over the years, Spain 4 years ago, their own Brazilian variations back through down through the years. I think the jury is still out as to whether this Brazil side are absolutely top class. Of course, they're up there amongst the favourites, but they're going to have to play better than they did tonight if they're going to win the World Cup.
Connor, what's happening tomorrow? What can we look forward to?
Well, I'm in Salvador, where we've got what's probably, certainly on paper anyway, the game of the group stages. We've got a replay of what was the final last time round, Spain against the Netherlands. That was a very close final, if you remember. There was red cards shown. Spain won it by just a goal to nil, Andreas Iniesta. And I'm sure over the last 4 years, those Dutch players, you know, first thing in the morning, every morning when they wake up, they will be thinking of that game. That was their chance to become world champions. The Dutch have been to 3 World Cup finals. They've never won one. And you just wonder, you know, is the chance going to come for them again this time around? It's a vastly different squad. If you compare the Spanish squad that won in South Africa 4 years ago, 16 of the players are still involved in the 23 this time around. For the Dutch, it's only 7. So there's a lot of young legs who've come in, but who don't have the international experience. Of course, they've got Louis van Hal, who's about to take over at Manchester United, and this will be his swan song for his country. He's won big. He's won league titles with every club he's been involved with, Van Hal. He's not had the success yet with the Dutch. He'd love to go out on a high. And what's interesting is, particularly because of injury, they've had to adjust their system. I mean, traditionally, the Dutch always go 4-3-3. They've had to adjust their system. They're going to play with 5 defenders. And this is going to be interesting to see how they smother Spain, who, you know, we think will go with this false 9 system. They won't play an out-and-out striker. Cesc Fabregas will play that central attacking role. And with these 5 defenders and holding midfielders, I think it tactically, it's going to be a really interesting game to watch. And it doesn't necessarily mean it'll be negative and dull from the Dutch, because anyone who saw Real Madrid and how they won the Champions League, they defended very deep, holding midfielders in front of the back 4. But then when they went on the counter-attack and guys like Bale and Ronaldo had the pace, that's where they were very exciting to watch. And I think that's what the Dutch will hope to recreate with the likes of Ian Robin doing the breaking, the counter-attacking play and trying to catch the Spanish out. So I think it's going to be a really intriguing game.
Yeah, should be an exciting game. Also got Mexico versus Cameroon, of course, and Chile versus Australia. Any news, Connor, on England's preparations for their game against Italy on Saturday?
I think for England, you know, we speak about the pressure the Brazilians are under. I actually think for the first time in a long time, there isn't a massive, massive expectancy pressure on England. I thought it would turn up a notch over the last few weeks, and it hasn't quite done so. I mean, I know people have been very impressed with Ross Barkley, and rightly so. He's looked fantastic. But people aren't getting carried away about England the way they usually do, and I think that's going to help the players. They can relax a little bit. They don't feel that any little mistake they made, they're going to end up in a pizza company advert. And I think that just might work out going in England's favour. But getting off to a good start is going to be absolutely huge. Everything we've heard is that the pitch is poor up in Manaus. But, you know, the Italians will have to play on that pitch as well. And I think if England can get a win, that'll really settle nerves down and win this one, and I think they will go through out of the group. However, lose it, and then they're playing catch-up immediately. So although it is just the first game, and this is the thing, you know, you compare a World Cup to a Premier League season. A Premier League season, you can have an off weekend. You can even have two or three of them over the season. You can still win the league. At a World Cup, you can't have a bad 10 minutes. You know, you could have a bad 10 minutes at a World Cup. You would have a player sent off. You would have maybe two goals conceded, and you're out of the World Cup. So those are the pressures the players are under. I think if England get off to a good start against Italy, who knows, they can. I mean, realistically, they're not going to go and win it. They're not going to get to the semi-finals. But I think England can get out of this group if they get a good start against Italy.
That was Five Lives' Conor McNamara. Now let's have a look at what's making the news stateside. Joined by John Sinniff from USA Today. Hello, John.
Good morning, Ian.
John, I'd imagine Iraq is dominating the news over there. Is that right?
Almost overnight it is. And I mean, as Iraq is tumbling toward what looks like civil war, the president came out today. He had to speak on this. And that's always a high indication that this is a foreign policy crisis as far as the United States is seeing it. He said, "I don't rule anything out because we do have a stake in making sure that these jihadists are not getting a permanent foothold." And then within not even an hour had passed, and his aides came out and said, "Well, we are going to rule something out. We're not going to have U.S. ground forces as an option." Iraq has been asking for air support already. The U.S. this year has already expedited weapon sales to Iraq. But really, this is it's tumbling into a huge crisis, a humanitarian crisis in Iraq, as I'm sure you've reported. And now it's a yet another foreign policy political crisis for President Obama and this White House.
Moving on, because we're running out of time, the story that's sure. kind of caught my attention is the smoking, the number of smokers in the USA.
Mm-hmm. This is specifically the government does every 2 years. They look and kind of check in on how teens are doing, what the health of teens is in this country. And since 1991, they've been doing this. Well, get this. Teens have been the lowest level ever since they've been measuring this. Just 15.7% of teens are current smokers in this past year. That's down from 27.5% when the survey began 20 years ago. And even at the peak, it was 1 in 3 teens in 1997 smoked. So this is tremendous. The government had set a goal of 16% by the year 2020. They've already surpassed that. But this is a broad survey. It also looks at drinking. They're drinking less alcohol, fewer sodas. They're getting in fewer physical fights. This is about the wellness of teens across the country. There are two bad things, actually, that the survey found. One is that condom use is down. They're not using condoms as much as they were, and they're the sexually active ones. It doesn't, you know, I won't go into the details of that. And they've admitted to texting while driving, and this is new data, so there's no comparison to other years, but 4 in 10 teens are doing that now. It's probably up because that was taken last year. It's really that scene is almost epidemic in this country.
It's not illegal, is it, to use the mobile phone or the cell phone when you're driving in the States?
It varies state to state. So right. in the state of Virginia, you can. You drive across the bridge and you can't in Maryland. It's insanity when you look at it in a mosaic of 50 states.
I saw some interesting footage of, a rather elderly gentleman jumping out of an aeroplane today. Who was that?
Yeah, he just happened to be our 41st president, George Herbert Walker Bush, and he turned 90 today.
Wow.
As he did when he was 80 and 85, he decides the way to celebrate his birthday is jumping out of a plane. And it's just fantastic because he has become kind of America's grandfather. He's a president that whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you agree he's a good person and he did right by the country and what he thought was right. And this was his 8th jump. The first one, by the way, he made after the Japanese shot down his fighter plane over the Pacific back in World War II in 1944. So just a tremendous story, a tremendous man.
It was my birthday last week. I was 41 and I just stayed at home watching TV and eating cake. Nothing quite as adventurous as that.
That's about what I would have done too. Good
John,
call.
Lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much, John Sinniff from USA Today.
Okay.
Coming up next on 5 Live.
After 2 o'clock, it's our health and fitness phone-in, and our regular expert, James Sangster, will be here to take all your questions. In many parts of the country, we've had the first hot weather in quite a while, so what should you do if it's just too hot to exercise? And with summer on its way, what's the best way to eat healthily in the sweltering heat? James has got some smart ideas on how to resist all that ice cream that you'll be wanting.
This is BBC Five Live, the home of Brazil 2014.
It's 2 o'clock on 5 Live. I'm Ian Lee. This is Up All Night. If you missed last night's opening World Cup match between Brazil and Croatia or want to hear more of 5 Live's World Cup coverage so far, go to the 5 Live website now to listen to Pint-Sized World Cup.
Now let's get the news. Here's Richard Foster.
This is BBC Five Live.
It's 5 minutes past two. This is Ian Lee, up all night, and this hour we'll be talking health and fitness, something very close to my heart, my clogged up, irregular, barely beating heart. If you've got any questions that you want answered, then do get in touch, and you can speak to our expert, James Sangster. You can give us a call, 0500 909 693. You can text 85058, or you can email upallnight@bbc.co.uk. James, nice to see you.
Nice to see you too, Ian.
You look really sporty, even at 6 minutes past two in the morning. You're wearing a tracksuit, you've got a big plastic beaker that you're drinking from, which is... does that make you healthier, having those plastic beakers? It seems to be healthy people that use them.
Yeah, definitely. It keeps you hydrated a lot. I've made a habit of it, including my clients as well. I just encourage people to just carry a bottle of water around with you.
It has to be water, does it? It can't be gin or anything like that.
Unfortunately not, unless it's a Saturday night.
Okay. 0500 909 693 is the telephone number. What? Let's kind of get an idea of your qualifications. What's your daily healthy active routine?
For myself?
For you, yeah. What do you do?
Basically, I train in a variety of different exercises.
Yeah.
I basically aim for general fitness overall, a lower body fat, and a healthy heart. That's my main goal. Basically, I wake up in the morning. I'll have a healthy breakfast.
Oh, no.
Unfortunately. Depends on the day. Sometimes if it's early, I'll go to the gym first,
yeah.
Come back and have some food. I just keep on top of eating completely clean. Every now and then, you know, have a bad snack, which I encourage to be.
I was saying this to someone earlier on. I've been a vegetarian for 25 years. And in the last 2 months, I've just started eating meat.
Right.
And so I've discovered sausages and bacon at breakfast. That's not particularly healthy, is it? That's not going to help me live a long and healthy lifestyle.
It depends on the quality of the meat. I mean, where you buy natural meat from, is it?
Sometimes I'm getting some of the good free-range stuff, and sometimes I'm just going for the dirty stuff.
Yeah, okay. It depends. Basically, if you get in, you know, the actual quality stuff that's got nutrients behind it, then yeah, it depends on exactly what the animal's been fed as well, exactly what's inside them sausages.
Does it really count what the animal's been fed? If they've been fed, you know, like the primo grass, it's going to be better for you than if they've just had some old cud.
Definitely. I mean, if you look at, say, the quality of chickens that have come from cages or the organic kind of chicken, it depends. If you've been given the same bit of corn every single day compared to grass and a healthy diet, it does affect the actual even the taste and even the texture of natural meat as well. So definitely, yeah.
Okay. 0500 909 693 is the phone number if you want to speak to James. He's a personal trainer. Now, when you do your personal training, do you go and do it in gyms, or are you one of those people that takes people out to parks and embarrasses them in public?
I do all sorts, to be fair.
Yeah.
I do online stuff.
How does that work?
It's basically, it's something I've started developing myself a bit more on my own, but it consists of, say if I had someone, because I'm from Manchester originally, if I had someone from London that I've never met before, I can have like a phone call with them online, you know, like a video chat. I can develop, say, I have to get to know them first, obviously, a few inductions and whatnot, consultations. I structure like I do a nutrition plan for them.
Right.
And then I'll basically give them like a basic workout depending on exactly where their fitness levels are. And if they struggle with any sort of exercises, I help with the form, you know, to demonstrate online. I can even basically draw up things you should be doing as well. So that's one factor. I'll go to parks with people if you need to do it there. I can go to the houses. I'll go to gyms as well. Completely depends.
How do you... I don't do much exercise. I've got two boys, 4 and 2. That's kind of my exercise, is carrying those guys around. But how do you motivate people? Because when I have exercised in the past, and every like 8 months a year, I think, oh, do you know, I should do a bit of running. I'm getting older and I'm getting a little bit of a tummy. I should do some running. And I'll do it for 2 weeks and then I just think, oh, stuff it. I can't be bothered. How do you keep that motivation going?
Well, I think with personal training, you have like a regular session. People vary. Sometimes you have 3 sessions a week, 2 sessions a week, 1 session a week.
Yeah.
If I'm there to help them out, and obviously they're paying for that service as well, it kind of motivates them even more.
If people are handing out dosh, then yes, they do feel a bit more motivated.
But it's also, it comes from the fact that, you know, they get inspired from me, and the fact that one thing I studied recently, this week actually, I've been away in Leeds for the week, it's about tapping into people's emotions. So I'll sit them down and ask them exactly what their goal is. And I'll, you know, ask them what that, why that goal is. So some people, you know, maybe for yourself as well, they'll say, you know, I've got a kid that's 4 years old and I want to just want to run around on the park with them, but I can't because I'm just knackered. So it's my job to ask them, you know, how bad they want that and just tap into their emotions. There's a lot of psychology behind it as well, you see.
Yeah.
But if you can really encourage people to do that, it helps out a lot and it gets people more committed.
Now, it's we've had some sunshine the last couple of days. It's been quite nice. It's a nice evening out, isn't it? When you're coming in, it's quite mild. It's wonderful. Not quite continental standards yet, but it's getting there. I would imagine that when it's hot like this, people find it harder to exercise. Is that right?
That's correct, with some sense. It depends exactly where people normally exercise. Some people that go to gyms, they're completely fine with the air conditioning. People that normally run outside, it is a lot harder, and it's something, again, I've been looking into because it's summer again. I always shine your fresh my ideas up. And I say to people, like, if you can, not everybody can, but if it's too hot, try running in the morning or late at night, because obviously that's when the sun goes down and temperature drops as well. That's the optimal time you can be training. I try and encourage it, because if it's going to be really hot, then it can dehydrate you a lot as well, so it can be quite detrimental to your health. So
we quite often holiday in Zakynthos, one of the Greek islands. My wife's half Greek, and when I'm there, I kind of think, do you know what? I'm going to eat healthy. I'm going to do a bit of exercise, and I'll get up quite early, about 6 a.m, and go for a little run. And I did this last year, and I got lost, and suddenly it's 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, and this is boiling. It's flipping boiling. And I thought I was going to die. I didn't quite. I managed to get into a bar and have a cool Coke to cool me down a bit. But you're right. Once that heat kicks in and you get to midday, it's just a killer, isn't it?
Exactly. It definitely is. I mean, I tried it because I went to Zakynthos last year as well.
It
hit like 40 degrees.
It's hot.
Oh, God, it was horrible. You know, and I tried, you know, going training in that heat, but it's just impossible. So you have to just wait for those times.
Because there are some people who would suggest that maybe the heat is the time to train, because you sweat more, you lose more weight. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. But it depends again on how long you're going to train for.
Yeah.
So imagine if you're running for an hour and a half and you haven't got any water on you, you're going to dehydrate yourself so fast. People like to run and dehydrate themselves and sweat themselves because they lose weight, but that's water weight, which can be easily put back on again by just drinking water. Does it make sense?
0500 909 693 is the phone number if you've got a question for James. Speaking of heat and humidity, obviously the World Cup it was kicked off today, yesterday. Mm. And they were talking about the atmosphere there being very hot and very humid. And also, a European team has never won in a South American World Cup just because the climate is so different. Mm. Is it going to be such a big shock for our players, for the England players, going from here over to Rio?
Definitely. I mean, one thing I used to do is I used to work with swimmers. And they used to go to different countries and, you know, train, basically get adjusted to that climate, because obviously they swim outside and whatnot.
Yeah.
It wouldn't surprise me. I've never looked into this bit, but it wouldn't surprise me if the team went over a month or so before. Mm. I could be wrong with that one. But normally...
they've been playing some warm-up matches, haven't they, in places like Miami, which is kind of similar.
It's basically like conditioning.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But yeah, it's because you've come from a natural habitat of yours, for myself, is Manchester. It's normally dark and grey and miserable.
Hey, it's been good the last couple of days.
Oh, yeah.
It's been fantastic.
I've been away. I've just come back today, though, so I wouldn't know.
You missed it. If you want to speak to James, you can text 85058. You can email upallnight@bbc.co.uk, or you can give me a call, 0500 909 693. Matt's in Manchester. Hello, Matt.
How you doing, boys? You all right?
Yeah, good, thank you, Matt. What would you like to say to James?
Well, I've increasingly become busier and busier with my job and had very little time to go to the gym in the last 12 months. A friend of mine who does a similar job to me, about a year ago, started a workout program called Static Contraction. I just wanted to know if James knew much more about it than I know. Essentially, what I know is that it's a high-intensity workout where you essentially do pretty much one workout a week on a body part. And he's pretty big, my friend. He's not got massive, but he's got very toned from this. Just wondered if he thought it was any good.
Have you heard of this, James? Trainer. Static contraction. It sounds like, what was the thing they used to talk about in the 50s? Dynamic tension, where you tense up and do your exercises. Have you heard of this?
I've heard of the static tension, but the thing is there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different, you know, exercise routines that people recommend to each other. But did you say, Matt, that he trains once a week?
Yeah, I think he's got two workouts. One of them is sort of shoulders, chest, and a couple of other body parts. And then, what you do is you do a static hold on your maximum one rep weight for about 7 or 8 seconds.
Okay.
And you literally just do one rep, and that's it. And then the next week you do it again. And the rule of thumb is that you can lift more every time you do it. And my friend swears by it. And as I said, he's got quite good results from it.
It could be down to other things as well. But the way I see it is any exercise is better than no exercise. There's always better methods you can use. I mean, one thing I say to people, because I have a lot of clients that are really, really busy people, and they can't fit in more than like 30 minutes. They can even do exercises in the office. But if you can get in, say, an hour's worth of a workout a week, then that's perfect. But if you could, I'd recommend more. I don't normally use this method of training with my clients. I normally do like a full body workout. It'll consist of, say, maybe 3 sets of 12 repetitions per muscle group. You can normally do just body weight exercises as well. But the main thing, I don't know if your friend has done this, but it could be down to what he's eating as well. I mean, how big was he, do you reckon?
I mean, he's not massive. He's not like an Arnold Schwarzenegger type bodybuilder, but he's very, very toned and in good shape. I think he eats a pretty normal diet. He's cut out bread, I know that much, and that's helped. But that leads me on to my second question, if I'm allowed another one.
You can have a second question, Matt. You've been so polite, of course you can.
It's kind of related in a way, but this is more on the cardio side. What do you think of interval training as opposed to just running at a constant speed for half an hour, actually doing sort of 30 second sprint and then a walk for say 20 seconds and then doing that until failure?
I swear by interval training. I encourage it to everybody.
Why is that better than going for a long run?
It's a lot more intense.
Yeah.
Say if you're going to get a run for, say, people run on the treadmill for, say, 60 minutes.
Yeah.
They'll get the heart rate to, say, 60% of what it can go to, you know, the maximum. Whereas if you go to interval training and you're doing, say, 20 seconds of a sprint and then 15 seconds of a rest, in those 20 seconds of a sprint, it could go up to, say, 80%, maybe 90%. So you're putting your body under, like, a lot more pressure on your heart. Does that make sense?
It sounds like such hard work.
It depends how committed
you are to it. That's the point of it, I'm guessing, is it?
It's supposed to be. But the thing is, instead of doing 60 minutes of a run on a treadmill, you could do, say, 20 minutes of interval training, and you've done practically the same amount of work.
Well, I was about to say, with Matt's first question, I was about to say there are no shortcuts, but now you're saying that there's a shortcut.
There's better ways of training,
but
there's no quick fix. Unless you starve yourself completely, which I would never, ever encourage to people, because it can have reverse effects.
Matt, does that answer your questions?
Yeah, tremendous. It's definitely given me food for thought.
Go and do whatever you need to do then.
Go for a run.
Go for a run, with a short one, and then have a rest, then go for a long one. He mentioned bread there. Bread's terrible. Listen, I've always been really, really skinny. Then when I turned about 35, I started to get a little pot belly, and it's still there. And if I don't eat bread for a couple of weeks, it just goes. Bread's pretty bad for you, isn't it, in that respect?
Yeah, it really, really is. And people don't realise it. I've taken it out of a lot of people's diets, because there's one I've been doing recently called the Paleo Diet. And it's just about eating natural foods. And bread's a huge one. I've said to people, because I've had, say, a client after, say, 4 weeks, I say, listen, you know, the bread's gone. How are you feeling? And they feel great. Mm. Honestly, it saps your energy. It's really strange. But it's basically the flour in there as well, and the grains.
It's just so delicious. You get a nice granary bread, and how else are you going to make a sandwich?
I'll have a sandwich. You can have a wrap instead if you really need to.
What about sugar? We were hearing about sugar is the new nicotine. It's terrible. And people are cutting sugar completely out of their diets. A tricky thing to do, but is it beneficial? Can it help?
It can help, but imagine I said to you now, like, okay, from right this second, you're cutting sugar out of your diet. It's impossible, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'd encourage people to cut down on sugar as much as possible, but the fact is that you have natural sugars as well. So imagine having fruit. Fruit's purely natural sugars. Oh. So I wouldn't encourage people to cut sugar out completely. Everyone's got different opinions on this.
Yeah.
But because of the culture we live in now and the way we've all been brought up, we've all had sugar in our diets for so long. But if you could drip your feed yourself off sugar, I'd say try and have a little bit in there every now and then, but mainly natural sugars, just fruits.
Okay. This is Ian Lee, up all night. It's coming up to 20 past two. I'm joined by personal trainer James Sangster. If you want to give us a call, 0500 909 693. Stephen's in Bedford. Hello, Stephen.
Good morning. It's strange talking to you this time of day.
Isn't it, just? Tell me, it's strange being up at this time of day. What would you like to ask James?
Well, next Saturday I'm doing the Three Peak Challenge, and I want to know what sort of snack should I take that'll give me that extra boost when I start flagging a little bit.
During the actual exercise?
Yeah.
There's a few things you can get. You can get like, you know, those glucose jelly beans. I'm not sure if you've seen them before. Or you can get isotonic sports drinks. And they're the best things you can have to
Isotonic means it's in balance with your body fluids.
Exactly.
That's John Barnes. Should you not be taking things like Mars bars and things like that to get a bit of a sugar?
We say rough. That normally at the end of a workout,
right? Okay,
because it's basically you've absolutely ransacked your store of energy. Basically, and the energy normally comes from sugar in your system. So that's when you should normally have a Mars bar. I have people that compete in all these body fat competitions, and they have like Haribo after a workout because it's just perfect. So it gets sugar straight back into your system.
Wow! If you do that though, aren't you going to put on a load of weight again? If you go and have some Tang Fastics or something,
if you only have say a small palm.
I couldn't do that. So go on, what should Stephen take with him then to help him get through the Three Peaks?
The main thing I'd say is a few days beforehand, what people normally do is they'll cut carbohydrates out for a couple of days beforehand, and then the day of the race just whack on carbohydrates, and it just gives you like a mad burst of energy. That'll keep you ticking over for quite a fair bit of it. And then during the actual Three Peaks is isotonic drinks. You can get like, you know, jelly beans, basically things that are quite high in sugar, but I wouldn't recommend a Mars bar.
Okay, well, they're supposed to help you work, rest and play. Stephen, have you done much training for this? Are you just going to be one of those people that rocks up and has a go?
Well, no, I do. Like, because I'm a milkman, I walk every day anyway, so hopefully that'll be enough. And I'm walking up and down the hills and all sorts of terrain, so hopefully that'll do me... Set me a good stead.
I don't know.
I've heard that nuts is a good thing as well.
Nuts, James.
Oh, nuts are brilliant. Yeah, people can easily overdose on nuts, though. I'd say seriously, a handful of them a day. They're really, really good for you, though. People get worried because they've got fat in them.
Yeah,
but it's a good fat.
People can overdose on nuts.
Not overdose, but you can have too many. Right. You can easily eat too many. Do you know what I mean?
Right. So, yeah.
It's about keeping everything in moderation, but nuts, I have nuts every day. Normally whack them into my breakfast with my porridge.
Stephen, best of luck with it. I hope it goes well.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. 0500 909 693 is the telephone number. It's interesting there. Stephen's job, he is a milkman, and he walks up and down all the time. And so he's constantly, apart from when he's in his little electric van, I imagine, he's constantly exercising. Now, my job... I'm sat behind a chair for a few hours a day, not doing anything. So I'm kind of at a disadvantage, aren't I? People who have office jobs, I would imagine, are at a disadvantage in terms of their health.
Definitely. It's because, imagine, our bodies aren't really designed for this. Do you remember when we first ever became on this earth?
I don't remember that, no.
You wouldn't remember. Obviously, you know about it.
Yes, yeah.
But basically... not many of us really sat around behind a desk, did we? You know, talking to a microphone.
Yeah.
We've just been going around hunter-gathering. That's our natural, instinct, basically. That's how we've survived and how we've developed. And the environment's evolved faster than we can keep up with it.
Mm.
So it's quite hard to keep on top of, but that's why people should start doing more exercise, because...
Are there exercises that people can do at their desk?
Yeah, there's a fair few, but you might get a few strange looks.
That's the thing, isn't it? But I suppose you could do it in lunchtime when there's nobody else around. Or you could get a little group of you doing it at the desk, doing some bits and pieces.
No, that's a brilliant idea as well. You could get like a little fit cam going inside your work. Imagine that.
If you want to speak to James, 0500 909 693, or you can send me a text, 85058. Now, it's hot. It's sunny, so people are going to want to drink fizzy pop and they're going to want to eat ice creams.
Mm-hmm.
Neither of those things, it turns out, are particularly good for you.
Definitely not.
are there any healthy alternatives, any things that people can do that aren't quite as damaging?
Yeah, there's one I've made for my family recently. I've seen a few things of it beforehand, but I've experimented a little bit with it. It's basically... People always want to reach for like an ice cream or, you know, chocolate or whatever.
Yeah.
One thing I've made, it's basically... It's not too hard to make. It takes a few hours, but get a chopping board, cling film over it, get some natural yogurt with honey.
Now you're talking.
Spread it all over the chopping board on top of the cling film. Slice up some strawberries, put them on top, sprinkle some pecan nuts, or you can have some pistachios, any kind of nut you want. Fold over the cling film, freeze it. It's like an ice cream bar for you there.
Hey, that sounds all right. Mm. That sounds quite nice.
Surely natural as well.
Yeah, I like the sound of that. It's weird, isn't it? Because our world is geared up for us to eat rubbish. It's easier to go out and buy, you know, rubbish than it is to buy something that's healthy and tasty.
That's completely true as well, and it's just become the culture that we're in now. It's becoming, you know, more and more frequent. People are just going for the easy option because this culture is all about convenience now. Because everyone's always busy, they're always rushing around.
Yeah,
they want something there and then. They never want to have quality foods. There are alternatives you can have to alternatives.
I think people have forgotten how to cook as well. My wife is half Greek, and so we get lots of fresh food cooked, and it's fresh ingredients. But that's a rarity these days. People don't know how to make meals from scratch and make healthy meals and freeze half of it to last them for the rest of the week.
That's correct. That's what I do as well. In fact, the other day, I mean, I did it. What I used to normally do is I've recently developed an allergy to tomatoes, which is horrible. But
How have you developed an allergy to tomatoes? It's just come up recently, has it?
Yeah, it sparks off like a skin reaction.
Wow.
It's ridiculous. I didn't have them for quite a while, and I started a new job that sells, like, you know, dishes with tomatoes in.
Uh-oh.
And boom. And it took me ages to eliminate what it was. And I had to have tomatoes today, which is quite bad because I was away basically on a course, and the only dish you had was tomatoes. So I'd rather have that than starve.
Yeah, so it brings you out in a rash or something, does it?
Yeah.
Gosh,
it's crazy. But I used to batch cook foods, and I still do now.
Yeah.
I've had to change around a little bit, but one thing you still do is people don't realise that cooking isn't as hard as people seem to think it is, because I have seen my friends, they'll come round to my house and they'll say, oh, we're going to get a takeaway, we're going to get a curry. I say, you know what, you order that and I'll make my own curry. I'll make it completely fresh, put my own ingredients in there, have coriander from the garden, chop it all up, put it all in there, and I'll batch cook it into a massive pan, put it in little cartons, put it in the freezer. It's there to take. It's so convenient, it's so easy. It takes 2 hours of your time maximum, and that's a week's worth of food right there.
Are there some people that are beyond hope, that they're so unfit, they're so overweight, they're so demotivated that there's nothing that you can do with them? Or do you reckon you could get results out of anybody?
I definitely believe I could, yeah.
Really?
Definitely. Thing is, it could take a lot of hard work,
yeah,
but anything's possible, honestly, absolutely anything. Some people just play ignorant to it. They think that, you know, there's nothing out there that can help them, whereas there actually is. They just need to talk to somebody, because I've noticed, like, a lot of people go into the gym and I'll go and talk to them and they think they're everything fine. They don't want like an induction, they don't want to talk to a trainer, they think they know it all. And that's how everybody is these days, and that's how I used to be as well. But people seem to think they're doing the right thing, and they're actually not. And they're kind of stubborn in the fact that they don't want help. But the people I go and approach realise they've done things wrong, and they're really appreciative of it. And I've noticed those people I've spoken to are actually having it's having a kind of massive impact in their life. They're actually changing things. Whereas people that refuse to accept the help don't get anywhere. But I definitely think anyone.
Gyms, sometimes I do wonder whether gyms are the best place, because we've all done that thing where in the new year we go, right, I'm joining up, I'm going to join the gym, and this is going to be the year I get fit. And 3 weeks later, they stop going to the gym. But maybe gyms need to do more to make themselves more attractive. They can be quite intimidating places, can't they?
It can be, and I'll admit that firsthand. I get a lot of people, you know, I'll have, say, 4 or 5 inductions a day, and half of those people come in looking absolutely intimidated. I'll sitting down the machine, it looks like a torture device.
Yeah. And it's full of buff people as well. Hot guys and girls who obviously go there every single day and work out and are very well defined. Some pasty, lanky, you know, muppet like me turns up, and it is an intimidating environment.
Well, that's what I thought as well, and I've been amazed that the most friendly and helpful people in there are the most scariest looking ones. It's basically the outlook everyone has in the gym. The people that are fit think that you wouldn't laugh at someone that's in a hospital that's ill, whereas you wouldn't laugh at someone that's overweight in the gym, because they're doing something about it. It's the same concept. You know, I'd rather have them in the gym and help them out. And that's why mainly everybody's mindset is in the gym. Obviously, you'll get, you know, one or two people. There always is that person out there. But most people want to help out. Other people just get the image that gyms are full of scary, judgmental people, and they're definitely not.
James, you're sticking with us until 3 o'clock. If you want to, are you normally up at this ridiculous time of the night?
Not normally, no.
But you're doing very, very well, good considering. James Sangster is a personal trainer. If you want to ask him any questions, this is your chance to get some free tips and advice. You can send a text, 85058. You can email us, upallnight@bbc.co.uk. But the best way, we've had a couple of great calls already, the best way to get in touch is to pick up the phone and call us, 0500 909 693. Right, look at that. It's 2:30 exactly. Let's get the news now with Richard Foster.
on digital, online, smartphone and tablet. This is BBC Five Live.
It's 2:35, it's up all night. My name's Ian Lee. We're joined by James Sangster, who's a personal trainer, and he's here to answer your questions on health and fitness. If you want to get in touch, you can text 85058. You can email upallnight@bbc.co.uk. The best way, of course, is to give us a call, 0500 909 693. We've got some texts for you, James. I eat a lot of cakes and sweets because of depression. Ah, I see. I find a sense of comfort from it. What can I do? And that is kind of a thing, isn't it? So there is a, you know, a recognised condition of eating cakes and sweets and things aren't particularly good for you to comfort yourself.
Yeah, there definitely is. And I encounter that, you know, that issue quite a lot with people. They find it quite hard to detach themselves and to, you know, to change that habit around.
Yeah.
One thing I say to people with that is, exercise is one of the best mood lifters in the world.
Yeah.
People never realise it until they actually do it. So I'm guessing with this, you're not as comfortable to go to a gym, you know, because you're just happy, you know, eating the food and whatnot, because it keeps you happy. So I'd say try and do some exercise in your house, even running up and down the stairs. Obviously, you know, be careful.
Yes, we don't want any accidents tonight, please. Mm. Not on my watch.
Even, you know, if you're just jogging on the spot, doing some press-ups, doing some sit-ups, as long as you're spending about half an hour of, you know, your time doing like a workout, you're going to start hitting that point where you're going to start enjoying it a lot more. Endorphins get released. And what normally happens with people, 9 times out of 10, is they think, you know what, I'm enjoying this. What's the point of eating a lot of crap? I want to eat good.
Mm.
So they start then, you know, changing it around a little bit. Sometimes people revert. But I'd say to you, you know, just try and change that around a little bit. Try and do some more workout. Try and, you know, bring down exactly how much cake you're eating. Try and eat more fruit. Try and eat more healthy foods. You know, more natural foods that aren't in bags or in tins or in boxes. Just natural foods. As long as, you know, you cut down a little bit. And then when you feel, you know, confident enough, go to your local gym.
We've got another text from Andy who says, as a lorry driver who only has a steering wheel to lean on for hours at a time, just listening to you yourselves talking about bread, what could I replace my lunchbox sarnies with?
One thing I really, really enjoy is I changed from having a carbohydrate meal to, it used to be like a smoked salmon salad.
Oh.
It was really, really nice. Yeah. Honestly, I worked it out. It's the same as like a takeaway burger meal. Mm. You can get like, well, it's pretty much the same price actually. Smoked salmon, spinach, a couple of peppers, chop them up in there as well. Cottage cheese. If you don't like that, change it with hummus. Mm. Sprinkle some dill in there as well. Just things like that can be changed so easily. If you can change your nutrition around, that's going to help you out a lot. Because when you're sat down for that amount of time, the last thing you want to do after driving for, say, 10 hours, I don't know how long you drive for, is you don't want to train. You just want to go to sleep.
Do you know what? That's the thing, because I'm doing a lot of driving at the moment, and eating healthily kind of goes out the window. Mm. And, you know, you stop at a petrol station, you fill up, and you do buy a bag of sweets, and you buy a pasty, and, you know, it is difficult. Maybe it's not. I make it difficult to not eat healthy when I'm driving. I wouldn't even dare show you the inside of my car because it's covered with sweetie wrappers at the moment. But are there different things that people can do to make those journeys, those meals on journeys, a little bit healthier?
Definitely. I always say to people, meal prep before you go out. I mean, say if you're going to go for a big journey, you wake up 50 minutes earlier, have a bowl of porridge. That'll keep you ticking over for quite a while. Maybe a banana as well. It's like slow releasing carbohydrates. Say if you had some fries from a takeaway. That's a really fast releasing carbohydrate. You're going to feel hungry again half an hour afterwards. So try and have things before you go out that are going to keep you ticking over, such as that. You know, you could have, say, sweet potatoes, for example. That's another great one. But oats, I'd encourage people porridge in the morning. That's the number one thing you can have, along with eggs. Say if you're on the road as well, try not to go to like a service station.
Mm.
Try to get to a supermarket as well, because you have so much more variety there. You can pick up, you know, hummus and carrot sticks. That's a perfect one. You can even have olives. Not many people are a fan of olives, but
I love a good olive.
Everyone loves a good olive.
I love a good olive. I didn't used to like olives. The first time I ever had an olive, I was told it was a grape. And so my mouth was set for grape. I had olive. It put me off. But I love a good olive.
Mm.
I want to come around your house. You're going to cook for me. It sounds like you've got some good recipes up your sleeve. I would imagine when there are big sporting events, Wimbledon, the Olympics, the World Cup, that there's kind of a surge in the number of people who take up sports. Would that be right?
Yes, correct. And the main time people get a surge for sport is New Year's. It's the main thing, New Year's resolution. But yeah, you're right. A lot of people start coming to the gym more because you see people, you know, running around the football pitch and think, you know, I want to be like that as well, you know, because it's like when, was it Ronaldo took his top off on the pitch the other week and everyone was going crazy seeing how amazing he looked.
Was it, I did not see, was he buff?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And it inspires a lot of people because I was sat somewhere with my friends and, you know, there's all these people around and like, oh my God. And you think they can't achieve it. Yeah. Well, it's so easy to achieve, but it does inspire people, definitely.
You say it's easy to achieve. How much work would you have to put in to look like Ronaldo?
Depends on body type. Depends on
look. Okay, my body type. How much work am I going to have to put in?
I'd say to get to his level.
Yeah,
about a year, maybe 2 years.
Ooh.
It's hard to do, but once you're in that loop, yeah, it's hard to stop.
You know, you can get spray on six packs. Have you seen? Seriously, you can. Have you seen those?
You can get implants as well. Have you seen those?
Suarez had an ACL, anterior cruciate ligament injury. What does that mean?
It's a ligament in the front of your knee. It's quite common with footballers, to be fair.
Right.
It's in there, like the top five. A lot of people get it and it puts them out for a very, very long time. It's quite frustrating. But it's a very, very common injury with footballers.
I suppose, again, this is another thing that might put people off doing exercise, is that it can be, if you're not doing it properly, it can be so easy to put your back out or strain yourself or, you know, strain a muscle or something like that. So I suppose you do, when you go to a gym in particular, you do need someone to show you how to use the machines properly.
Definitely, definitely. That's why with the gym I mainly go to, any induction has to go through, any new member has to go for an induction, because they think, you know, again, they play ignorant, so they know it all. And before you know it, they've been put out, they're injured for a few weeks, means they can't train for that time, and you go back to square one, they don't want to go to the gym again. So if you see a fitness professional first, even just if it's like for an induction, you're going to save yourself a lot of work.
If you want to ask a question about health and fitness, up all night at bbc.co.uk. 85058 is the text, or you can give us a call, 0500 909 693. Some people haven't got the time, they haven't got the money or the inclination to join a gym. What can they do at home?
All sorts. I have, it's quite hard to, you know, say every single exercise I can do and non-construct it online for people, mainly through Twitter, to be fair. But what I normally do is say a full body workout, could be press ups, a few squats, some lunges. Some people won't know what these exercises are. It's basically, you know, just pretending to sit down and back up again. That's a squat.
Okay, right.
Nice and easy. Lunging forward with your leg.
Yeah.
Press ups. Everybody knows what a press up is.
Press ups are really hard to do. You probably find them a piece of cake. But again, it's one of those things. Every now and then I think, right, I'm going to do some press ups before I go to bed. And I've done seven and I'm out of breath.
You done, yeah.
Yeah. It's hard work.
Well, you know, everyone's got different starting levels. everybody.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
But some people always think that when you go and see a trainer, they're going to beast you, as they say, or they're going to smash you. It's not like that at all. Say if people can't do normal press-ups, I'll get them, you know, going on their knees and doing a half press-up as well.
Yeah.
It's basically building that foundation up and then taking it from there. So don't go in full throttle if you can't.
If I were to challenge you to a press-up duel now, how many could you do?
God, I don't even know.
Like 100?
I've tried 100 before and I was shaking after it.
Really? But you did it?
I did it. It took me a while. I don't know if I could do it now.
Wow. 0500 909 693 is the phone number. Paul's in Newcastle. Hello, Paul.
Hello, good evening. How are you?
Yeah, good, thank you, Paul. What would you like to ask James?
Yeah, I was just wondering about a training session for 5K, you know, because I used to do like longer distances, but that's about the maximum I think I can run now. And would weight training help at all for that? I've been doing some weight training and swimming and things like that, you know. Is that a benefit when you're doing it, like, say, a 5K or whatever, you know?
Yeah, it definitely is. People think that just running on a treadmill is going to, you know, build up that level where you need to be at for a 5K. It mainly does come down to the treadmill for the cardio side, increases, you know, lung capacity and whatnot. But weight training is a definite. It can increase your power. It can increase your endurance. It can increase, you know, when you get that burning feeling in your legs and it's really tiring you out. If you can work on that, when you start getting a buildup of, like, you know, lactic acid, every time you train on weights, you can resist that more and more and more, which means you can run further, faster and longer.
Yes.
Paul, do you do much exercise?
I used to run quite regular, but I was in a car accident about a year ago, and I'm just getting back into it now, so I'm trying to build up my enthusiasm again, for exercise and actually maybe do a park run kind of thing, race or something like that, you know.
So did we don't go into detail if you don't want to, but was it quite a serious car accident? Did you injure yourself?
I had some quite bad whiplash. I've still got a few aches and pains.
Yeah.
But it's finally resolving itself now. And that's why I've got my enthusiasm back up, you know, because I put on a little weight.
Mm.
And I've been interested in listening to the lad about James about the diet and that. You know, that would be useful for me as well, you know, to because I eat quite a lot of bread because I work as a taxi driver. And I make sandwiches and things like that, you know, basically that's what it is. Yeah.
Well, Paul, listen, best of luck. Don't, you know, I guess the advice would be, James, is just if you're coming back from an injury, just take your time. Don't go nuts to start with.
Definitely. I mean, one thing I was going to say to Paul is, like, if, you know, you need help with that nutrition side of it, I'm more than happy to do that.
Okay.
Am I okay saying my Twitter name on there?
Of course you can, yeah.
I'm not sure if you've got Twitter, Paul, but it's @FocusJames. It's just one whole word. If you need help with that, just seriously get in touch with me, send me a message, send me a tweet.
Yeah.
I'll be more than happy to help you out with that.
Could you just repeat that again? I missed that, yes. Sir.
It's @FocusJames.
Focus, James. Yeah, okay, Jim. I'll get in touch with you.
Paul, there you go. Yeah. You can't, Paul. Thank you very much. You can't say fairer than that. Free advice. So, bread we know is going to make you a little bit porky pie. What other food? Pasta, I guess, as well is going to kind of bloat you a little bit.
Yeah, definitely pasta. It's like refined products like white bread. Awful. It's got flour in there, cakes, pasta. It's a huge one. A lot of people I ask always say, you know, I say, what did you have for tea last night when I've got a client? And it's always spaghetti bolognese.
Pasta sounds so healthy though.
Mm.
Sounds like a healthy option. I had a bit of pasta last night, but it's you're going to feel it around your gut.
Yeah. It's a fast releasing carbohydrate. What they are is it's higher in a sugar count, and what normally happens is it spikes blood sugar up, and then to counter that, because it goes too high normally, your body then releases insulin, which then decreases it all back down again. And what happens is it tries getting rid of all that sugar, and it just gets stored as fat. So those kind of foods can spike blood sugar levels a lot.
Do they still have pasta parties before the London Marathon? They used to do that. I'm so old. In the 80s, they would all have big pasta parties the night before. So they were kind of had loads of energy for the next day. I don't know if they still do that or not.
It's normally, just before the race. No, not just before. Sorry, you know, a few hours before and having a meal or the night before. Because again, you know, like I said, you know, you starve yourself for carbohydrates for a while. Because what happens is your body's craving those carbohydrates for energy. And then just before the race, you get a massive boost of energy from those carbohydrates. So pasta, in that sense, is okay. But if you're eating pasta and you're not training, you're not eating healthily, it's going to be detrimental.
Okay, 0500 909 693. It's 2:47.
On DAB Digital Radio, Digital TV, downloads and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live. Up all night.
John's in Leicester. Hello, John.
Good morning to you, Ian.
Good morning to you, John. You're sounding very perky at this time of the night.
Well, yes, I shouldn't, I suppose, at this time of the night, but that's the nature of my lifestyle at the moment. I'm awake at this time of night with too much energy.
What would you like to ask James?
Right, for the last year, I've been dieting and training. I've lost 4.5 stone in the last year, but I've still got a lot of flab around my stomach. I'm just struggling to get rid of the excess fat around my stomach. The weight loss has been great. I feel so much better. I train an hour a day in the gym.
Yeah, good.
But I just can't get rid of this fat.
Is it around the abdomen as well?
Just purely around there. Everywhere else is fine. My lifestyle is pretty sedentary work-wise. I sit in a car or behind a desk all day long, so I realise it's a muscular problem as well. So, any suggestions?
Yeah, how much water do you drink a day, roughly?
Loads and loads and loads.
Loads of water. What I normally say to people is, I had this conversation with a guy today, he was a personal trainer himself, and he's really, really struggling to lose that last little bit of fat there. What happens is, people come to me, and they ask me how can lose, like, you know, fat in certain areas, because you always think it can spot reduce the fat.
This is exactly what I'm talking about, spot reduction.
Yeah, it's basically, it's not going to be spot reduction. You're going to lose a bit from, say, your legs, a bit from your arms. It's all in proportion.
It's all gone. You know, but not around my stomach.
Oh yeah, the last place you lose it is the stomach. It's about it's a few tweaks with the diet, basically.
What do you suggest he does then, James? To get that?
Have you ever had green tea before?
Yeah, I don't like it, but I would have it if it helped.
Because you can have green tea. You know, those little tablets you can get as well.
I didn't know about the tablets.
Yeah, it's green tea tablets. There's a fair few places that sell those, but that's honestly a really, really beneficial factor, and a lot of people.
How does that work?
It's like a concentrated. When you got like the tea, it's basically you've still got the leaves in there, and it's really refined down leaves, so you get in.
So green tea is going to help you lose weight.
Increases metabolism. Honestly, it's amazing. It's really, really good.
It is an acquired taste. The green tea. Would you? You're saying have that instead of what? A cup of coffee, a cup of normal tea.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, apart from today with this brew, I've not had a brew in months. I don't normally drink them, but I just got offered one, so I may as well. But green tea is...
I mean, I don't drink tea, I don't like tea, but if it's in a tablet form, that's different.
Definitely. I mean, another thing I do as well is with the water, people get bored of that, is I normally get like, I haven't got it right now, but I'd get like a lemon and a lime, cut up into little wedges, and then put that in the water as well. That can also help increase metabolism.
Well, I've got some powder, which I put in the water to make it palatable, because again, I don't like water as such, and that's my substitute for it just helps to get the water down my neck, and I put a lot of that down my neck each day.
Well, John, go and have some green tea and see if that helps. Thank you for your call. 0500 909 693. Paul's in London. Hello, Paul.
Hi there,
Paul. What would you like to ask James?
Yeah, what it is, I've got a problem. I've started doing a circuit of running. It's about a 4-mile circuit, and I basically sort of go out and I keep getting an injury on my legs. Now, it's actually the part of my lower legs, which is below my calf, but it seems to be above my Achilles. Okay. I don't know if there's like a tendon there, and I keep straining it. When I get about 3 months worth of running, I'm getting quicker and quicker, and then I seem to pull something in my lower leg. Now, it can happen on either leg. I've got proper running trainers as well. I actually went to a proper running shop. I had my gait assessed. I run pretty neutral. He gave me the trainers which suited my running style, and it's great for about the first 3 months, and then as I get quicker, I seem to pick up this injury, and it just completely stops me tripping track, because then I sort of can't run for a week or two, and then as soon as I start running again, within, like, literally it might happen the first time, it will go again. So I've tried putting sort of like tubey grips on my lower legs to try and give them a bit of extra support, but they'll still go. So I don't know what I'm doing, why it would go, and what can suggest that I can do, really.
There's a couple of factors you can do with this one. Again, do you drink a lot of water or not?
I do, yes. I drink water. I have a bottle of water with me during my working day as well, so I'm constantly drinking like as much fluid, not just water, but I'll drink sort of tea with skim milk.
Okay.
That's my sort of drink, because water can get boring, but I'll have water as well, just to sort of fill in the gaps to make sure I don't go thirsty. But what I do as well, I don't know if this is significant, but I will go for the run as soon as I get up. So I'll get up, I'll have a nice drink, and then after about half an hour, I'll stretch as well. I'll do like stretching before I go running. I'll do calf stretches.
Yeah.
Where I'll put one foot in front of the other and I'll lean forward, keep my back straight to sort of pull me, like, stretch my calves, because I've been told I've got tight calves as well. So, but it's this area below my calf and above my Achilles that I keep getting a strain on, and I just can't run. And it's, you know, and it's, you know, and I'll rest it for a week or two, think it's okay.
And then I'll run back again, and then it'll go again.
Oh, James, what do you reckon?
There's one thing you can try. It's this thing called, you've got fascia. It's, you know when you have like a chicken breast, it's got that white streaky stuff on it. We have that in our bodies as well. What happens is, on the bottom of your foot, it runs from there all the way up your leg. That's one issue I have a lot with a lot of people. If you want to help out with that, it could be this. I'm not going to guarantee it. But if you get, say, a tennis ball or a hockey ball, if you can't get one of those, a golf ball, that's a last resort, is just put it on the bottom of your foot, the base of it, and just move it around in a triangle, put a bit of pressure on there. That'll loosen up all the fascia on the bottom of your foot. That can then...
what is that, like a kind of gristle or something?
It's... have you seen a chicken breast? Obviously, you know when you cut them up and you've got that white strand that's...
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
It's basically that. That's what you've got in our bodies. People don't really realise this kind of stuff. You can get like a build-up of toxin in... in your muscles as well. So if you can get a foam roller and roll it, so you're like, say if you're laid down and you get the foam roller on the floor and you put your bottom leg on it and put as much pressure as you can on that lower leg that's on the foam roller and just roll it up and down, it can help remove toxins. So it could be that as well. So try the ball on the bottom of the foot in a triangle movement. Say do that for like 30 seconds on each foot, swap around say 3 or 4 times, and then a foam roller. Do you know what a foam roller is?
I don't know what a foam roller is.
Really,
no, go on, tell us.
Okay. They're normally found in gyms. You can go to sports shops. It's like a cylinder. You can probably get both hands around it. It's pretty much that wide. If you can get one of those, you can. If you go to like the local gym, basically, and just use one of those and just roll it around for about 30 seconds again. If it hurts in a certain area in your leg, try and focus on that one as well a bit more.
Paul, listen, I wish you the very best of luck. I hope you manage to sort it out. He sounds keen. He sounds keen for it to work, but doesn't necessarily look like it is at the moment. Well, good luck, Paul. I hope you manage to sort that out. I am an inherently lazy man, James, and I think that's my great downfall when it comes to exercise. I do enjoy a bit of swimming. Swimming is particularly good for you, isn't it? Because you're working everything.
Yeah, you're working the whole body, and a lot of people don't realise exactly how much work you're doing, because think about it, when you're normally on a treadmill or you're doing any kind of weight, you're sweating a lot, aren't you?
Yeah.
But when you're in a pool, you don't realise how much you're actually sweating. Because it's just constantly going into the water as well. Swimming is fantastic for people. I do it myself. My girlfriend's a swimming teacher, and she swears by it as well.
Mm.
So it uses every muscle in your body pretty much.
We can squeeze in, I think, one more call. Tony's in London. Tony, what would you like to ask James?
Oh, hello, good evening. I'd like to know if you think that there is an optimum optimum heart rate for burning fat. So if you're training, depending on your age and your weight, is there a heart rate that you should aim for that's going to burn fat as opposed to burning carbohydrate or anything else?
I hope you don't mind me asking how old you are. Is that okay?
I'm 49.
49, okay. Maximum heart rate
14
is...
14 stone.
14 stone. Okay, yeah. Try and keep your heart rate. There's no specific, you know, set number. If you go over by 5 or 10 on each side, it's not going to matter too much. But what are you normally getting your heart rate up to at the minute?
Well, anything from 140 to 160, 170.
That's the optimal range for fat burning, in fact. But are you just running on a treadmill? Yeah, are you just running on a treadmill?
If I'm running on the treadmill, there's obviously heart rate there, but I've got a heart rate monitor, you know, if I've got a Concept 2 at home, you know, I monitor my heart rate on that with a separate heart rate monitor. Or, you know, if I'm on a cross trainer, you know, I'll wear that and I will keep an eye on my heart rate.
Mm. As long as you're feeling quite tired after your workout as well, definitely don't focus too much on heart rate, but as long as you're getting yourself worked up as much as you can, your maximum heart rate is 220 minus your age. So did you say 48?
49.
Yeah, 49, okay. So that's, was it one?
Don't ask me to do maths when it's coming up to 3 o'clock in the morning.
No, I can't do maths at this time either.
Tony, 220 minus your age. I wish, well, listen, we're out of time, I'm afraid, Tony. Sorry about that. But okay. James will be back next week, no doubt, so you can ask him. Is part of the problem, James, and we've only got 20 seconds here, that people kind of worry about this too much and they don't enjoy, you know, they don't have fun doing exercise, playing games, going out and having a kick around with their mates. You know, they're too busy monitoring their heart rate and too busy counting their calories and things like that.
Exactly. I say to people, if you're not enjoying yourself, then why are you doing it? You have to be enjoying yourself. focus more on having a good time. Definitely.
James, what's your Twitter address if people want to follow you?
@FocusJames.
Excellent stuff indeed. Well, thank you very much. I'm sure you'll get lots of people tapping you up for a little bit of free advice. James Sangster, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Coming up next on 5 Live.
Right, coming up before 4, the film starring UN Special Envoy Angelina Jolie speaks out against rape as a weapon of war. We hear from the pensioner arrested after giving his wife a painkiller patch. And Australia has given the English language so much, from Barbies and Tinnies. But is the country's inimitable slang dying out?
This is BBC 5 Live, the home of Brazil 2014.
It's 3 o'clock on 5 Live. I'm Ian Lee, and this is Up All Night. It's 6 minutes past 3. This is Ian Lee. Welcome now to The Fix. Over the next hour, we'll take a look at some of the most compelling stories to make it onto the BBC over the last 24 hours. We'll hear from a woman fleeing the Islamist violence in the north of Iraq. A leading lawyer warns that the principle of open justice is under threat in the UK. And is Australian slang dying out? The first reports from Iraq say government forces have conducted airstrikes against Islamic extremists who've taken over large areas of the country. Fighters from the Al-Qaeda splinter group ISIS have now vowed to march onto Baghdad after seizing the cities of Mosul and Tikrit. Many of those who fled the violence in Mosul in the north of the country have gone to the Kurdish town of Erbil. That's where Isra Yusuf is. She's been telling Five Lives' Peter Allen how her family fled Mosul when the militants arrived.
My family left this morning. They've stayed there from the beginning of the attacks, and they left this morning. The militant groups, they've taken over Mosul. It's in their hands. All of the checkpoints that were previously controlled by the Iraqi army has gone. They've all been taken over by the militants.
And what's happening in Mosul itself, do you know?
In Mosul itself, yes, we had a relative. He went into Mosul and he said they've spoken to the people. They've actually, our family members have spoken to them, and they said, we don't want to hurt anyone. We the only people we're after is the army. That's it. We want to control this. They have speakers. They play their, like, songs. This is jihadi Islamic stuff, and you can hear them. It's on, like, a loop, and they go around all the neighborhoods, and they play it.
What's happened to all the army, the Iraqi army? They just thrown away their weapons and gone.
Yeah. I think it was on Tuesday evening. That was the worst night in Mosul. My mum and my sisters, at 11, I think it was 11 or 12 p.m., they left the house with nothing. They ran out the house. They had a car and they just left. They saw with their own eyes, like, the army would take off their clothes, leave their weapons, all of their cars, and just run. They were just running.
Have there been many casualties?
Quite a lot, yeah. Just the neighborhood where we live, right next to our house, there were 4 children. They got caught up in a collision and 4 of them died.
And has there been shooting as well?
A lot of shootings. The night that they escaped, there's been rocket fires, a lot. They're still shooting now, like, there. It's uncertain. Everyone in Mosul has pretty much left, or they have packed bags, they're leaving. No one is staying inside the city. Like, even though they have spoken to the Islamic militant groups, they have actually told them, you know, if you want to stay, you can stay. If you want to leave, you can leave. But we can't promise you that you're going to be safe, because if the army, because there's allegations that they're going to start sending a plane, the Iraqi army, they're going to start attacking them.
Is that what people are afraid of as well? They're afraid of the violence which is going to follow. That's why they're running away.
Yeah, they're afraid of the violence. They know they're going to get caught up in it, and that's the problem. They have a lot of people have been got caught up in the violence, and that's why they're all running. They don't want to be part of it.
Yeah, we're hearing, even as you speak, that the Iraqi television is saying that the Air Force is bombing positions in Mosul. So there's going to be a war in Mosul, and people just don't want to be caught up in it. I guess that's what's happened.
Yeah, everyone has pretty much left. The Shia majority has completely abandoned everything. There was a small Peshmerga office right behind our house. They left as well, and they're protecting, there's a small Christian area called Bartila. They're protecting that area, the Assyrians. There hasn't been any problems between the Peshmerga and the militant so far, but there are a lot of rumors that they're going to attack. There's going to be an attack. No one knows for sure what's happening. Like, every family that, like, my mother and sisters were in contact with, they had all packed bags and put them in the cars. They're waiting for, like, an attack or something to happen. They're going to leave.
Mm. What do you make of ISIS? What do you think they're like, and what do you think they want? Are they going to take that area over? Do you think that's what's going to happen?
Well, the thing is, Mosul is huge. It's massive. For me, I did not believe. I kept telling them, "You're fine. I'm not going to." Especially the part where we live, it's way outside of Mosul. It's a small village way outside of Mosul. And the fact that when my mom and sisters, they came through, they actually had contact with the members. They said that they were searching people's cars. They didn't mind. They were telling people, go about your work, go about your days, and we're not going to attack you. We know who we're targeting, and it's not civilians. But there's a major, like, crisis because no one has food. There's no gas. There's no electricity. That's the major problem right now there.
We've heard that there have been executions sometimes when they have caught people they want in the streets.
Yes. Well, if they know that you worked in the government or that you have affiliations with the army or the government, they do. They have a list of every single person living inside the city. They know
who.
That's
amazing. So this is all. I mean, is this all new? Have they been on the outskirts of the city? How have they got such a grip of the place so quickly?
Yeah, that's the thing. No one knows. And when our friends went and spoke to them, they said they're not from Iraq. Like, most of them are not from Iraq. They said there's a mix of Afghanistani and Pakistani people. They said a lot of people from Morocco, Saudi Arabia. They were like, you can see that, you know, they're not Iraqi, not all of them anyway. And the fact that they got control of Mosul, which is, like, it's huge, and the fact that they have complete control over it. All of the checkpoints, they have control over it.
That's amazing and terrible for you. I mean, what is that the end for the idea of a united Iraq? I mean, do you feel as if that's over?
Definitely. I mean, I don't. The thing is, what people, Mosul has a huge military base. When I used to go there from Erbil, I would go through like 10 checkpoints, and there would be so many soldiers, and they would be searching through our cars and, you know, being so brave. And yet, the fact that there's not one of them there, my sisters showed me clips, there's not one soldier in those checkpoints left. And these militants, I can't imagine how many of them there are. I read somewhere that there was like around 3,000 to 5,000. There's over 14,000 Iraqi troops that should be in Mosul. No one knows where have they gone.
Isra Youssef, who fled Mosul with her family this morning as militants entered the Iraqi city, speaking to Five Lives' Peter Allen. An absolutely incredible story there. Now, whether it's over Russia, Syria, or now Iraq, President Obama has been heavily criticised for being weak on foreign policy. One of the biggest talking points in Washington is still whether he made the right decision in swapping 5 Guantanamo detainees for an American prisoner of war, Bo Bergdahl. Well, the Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, has had to appear before a House committee to answer questions about it. And I would just, hang on a second, my computer's just chosen to freeze now, which is excellent timing, thank you. But what impact has this episode had on the debate about Guantanamo Bay itself? Lawyers for some of the inmates say they feel any imminent releases may have been put on hold in the backlash against the Bergdahl deal. Ali Makbul reports from Washington.
We're going to pay for this. There is not any doubt in my mind there are going to be lost lives associated with what came out of this.
Republicans are keeping up the pressure. Leader of the House, John Boehner, is among those who continue to say it was wrong for 5 Taliban detainees to be released from Guantanamo Bay in exchange for the American prisoner of war, Bo Bergdahl.
This morning, I called Bob and Jannie Bergdahl and told them that after nearly 5 years in captivity, their son, Bo, is coming home.
When it happened, it was a moment the president clearly wanted to savor, but how quickly things changed. The sudden deal without the approval of Congress led to a huge backlash, with implications not just for the Obama administration, but some worry the future of Guantanamo and its around 150 detainees, some of whom were expecting to be released. Professor Ramzi Qasim is the legal representative for several Guantanamo inmates, including the last British detainee, Shakir Amir.
Unfortunately, I think it would be downright outrageous for
politicians to scapegoat the many dozen cleared prisoners of Guantanamo who have been long approved for transfer out of Guantanamo as a result of the Bergdahl affair, and to stonewall their releases in order to retaliate against the Obama administration for failing to notify Congress.
Some don't understand why there's been such an angry reaction to the prisoner swap. After all, before all of this, the sense had been that the recently announced strategy to withdraw troops from Afghanistan over the next 2 years would have to mean the camp's closure. It's why even the legal advisor during the Bush administration, John Bellinger, who then endorsed the existence of Guantanamo, says the deal was defensible.
The Taliban were going to need to be returned from Guantanamo as the conflict in Afghanistan winds down at some point in the next couple of years. These are principles of the traditional international laws of war that require combatants to be returned at the end of the conflict.
It's something I put to former Republican presidential nominee John McCain in the Senate. He was having none of it.
So isn't it better to get something in return for detainees who are going to be released in any case? Isn't it better to get something in return?
That is one issue that has been raised. They are not going to be released anyway. Under the law of war and the authorization of the use of military force, is they can be retained and detained indefinitely, and they should be.
Even when
so
the war's over?
What do you mean when the war is over? The authorization of, you know, what are you talking about, the war against the Taliban? You think it's over? The authorization of the use of military force, which remains in effect and will remain in effect, will mean that they will be kept.
Of course, the most sensitive question is, what do you do with those suspected of the worst crimes, massacres, who remain in Guantanamo? But it's got to the stage where even John Bellinger, the Bush administration man who used to try to convince European politicians that Guantanamo was a good idea, says the camp has to close as soon as possible.
Guantanamo, in my view, has certainly damaged the reputation of the United States.
But you were somebody who, at one stage, was defending the existence of Guantanamo.
My job as the legal advisor for the State Department, of course, was to explain why we were holding people in Guantanamo. Well, certainly one can look back at many events in history and see that they did not work out.
But there is one big obstacle to the closure of Guantanamo Bay. Detainee lawyer Professor Ramzi Kassim again.
It, as with all things Guantanamo, boils down to politics. If the Obama administration is serious about reducing the numbers of prisoners at Guantanamo and ultimately ending indefinite detention there, then they should just go ahead.
But from the president appearing in the Rose Garden with Bo Bergdahl's parents to the Republican fury there's been since, Guantanamo is an issue which has been so highly politicized by both sides that there's utter paralysis when it comes to finding a way forward. Of course, of late, Washington has become a city littered with issues like that.
The BBC's Ali Makbul reporting from Washington. It's 3:18. Now, a leading lawyer has told Five Live that Britain risks sleepwalking into a situation where the principle of open justice is being steadily undermined. It follows a ruling from the Court of Appeal that the central part of a major terrorism trial should be held in secret for security reasons. The judges decided that only some parts of the prosecution's opening statement and the verdicts could be heard in public. They've also allowed the defendants to be named. They are Errol Insidal and Munir Ramubahuja. Criminal barrister John Cooper QC has been speaking to Five Live's Phil Williams.
Initially, a single judge decided, on information we've not even been told about really, that exceptionally, probably the first time in English legal history, a complete trial would be in secret. Now, what happened is this was appealed, and the Court of Appeal decided that this went too far. And what the Court of Appeal said was that you cannot have a whole trial in secret and the anonymity of the defendants. And so what the Court of Appeal did is, in my view, really just tampered at the edges of the ruling. And what we've got now is that we can hear a little bit of the opening speech, we can hear a little bit of all the procedural stuff at the start, but again, the guts of the case is going to be in secret, including, it seems, the evidence of the defendants, if they choose to give that.
Do
Do you fear now for the centuries-old principle of open justice, given that you've got a Home Secretary and a Foreign Secretary here signing certificates to apply for this?
There is an erosion, a slow erosion, which is really going on, I think, under the radar, as far as many people are concerned, as to some sacred cows and some important sacred cows, as far as the criminal justice system are concerned. Take into account also the erosion of the right to jury trial, which is disappearing as well. People don't realise what's happening there. Take that on top of the growth of secret trials. Yeah, and I think people should wake up and see what's going on here. This particular secret trial has been granted, but it still really is a secret trial, has been granted upon material that we haven't even got the basics of. I've been involved in cases where national security has been claimed by those representing the security services, and when we've challenged it, it's actually turned out to be nothing more, nothing less than political embarrassment, and they've dropped it when challenged. I am concerned that we should be losing a basic right here, and it's not just the basic right for the defendants, put that to one side, it's a basic right for society to see what's being done in their name. And what's happened here is that the fundamental principle of open justice has been taken away, and we really don't know even the basic principles why.
Difficult, though, isn't it? Do you have any sympathy for the government? Because it's very difficult for them to explain why without letting the cat out of the bag, isn't it? I mean, presumably the reason why is the reason why they want it secret in the first place.
It is chicken and egg, that sort of thing. And I was about to say, I do understand there are certain aspects, particularly in modern-day criminality, or alleged criminality involving alleged terrorist offences, whereby it's absolutely right that the work of the security services is not compromised. But what we have here is really a blanket secrecy, and I say again, I don't think we should be fooled into thinking that the ruling that we're discussing takes away the fact that it's fundamentally still a secret trial.
Although what we do have here, John, is a small number of accredited journalists who will be allowed to witness all but the most sensitive parts of the evidence. Even if they're not allowed to report that, there will be some independent witnesses.
You see, that troubles me. In no way whatsoever should anyone commit a crime, no way whatsoever should anyone breach court rules. But it's putting those journalists in a very invidious position. They cannot and should not breach court rules. That would be extremely wrong, and they should not do it. But what do they do if they sit there and they hear something that concerns them? It's going to be a very difficult one for the journalists. They cannot cause a contempt of court, and they've got to sit there effectively and assist in being a rubber stamping of what's going on. I find that...
Yeah, they won't be allowed to take their notebooks out of the courtroom.
Well, I'm just wondering, what is the purpose of them being there? They can't say anything that's going on, and they shouldn't say anything that's going on, because that's the rule that the court have laid down. They're going to sit there, hear things, are not going to be able to do anything about what they hear.
Well, other than, the only thing that struck me is that, and there is precedent for this, isn't there, with 30-year-old cases, but I just wonder if in time the secrecy order is lifted and then there is a neutral account of what's happening in court.
Well, if the secrecy order is lifted in time, but when is that going to be lifted? Many, many years hence, I would have thought. But I think going back to the basic principle here, it's important that security services modus operandi are protected. But often there are knee-jerk responses in cases, and I've been involved with them myself, where there is blanket secrecy and there does not need to be blanket secrecy. My concern here, my overall concern here, is that we are sleepwalking in many respects into a regime where we have secret trials, the open justice principle is dismissed more and more without really a close analysis. Take on top of that also the erosion of right to jury trial. I think people should at least be debating this and discussing it and just seeing where the balance lies.
That was criminal barrister John Cooper speaking to Five Live's Phil Williams. Now, the film star and UN Special Envoy Angelina Jolie has been speaking at a global summit on sexual violence in London. She joined the UK Foreign Secretary William Hague to warn that rape is being used systematically and deliberately as a weapon of war against women. They've both been speaking to the BBC's Jane Hill.
My key message is to follow up this summit with action and to make sure that when we visit them in the field and we see these governments, we shake their hands now and years to come, that we are all actually doing something on behalf of all of these people that they will meet today, and they will hear their stories, and they will come face to face with the victims from their own countries, and they will hopefully not just forced to act, but they will also really deeply want to.
You want them to know that you are going to hold them to account?
We will absolutely hold them to account.
Foreign Secretary.
This is a subject that the world didn't want to talk about for a long time. You know, we are now having a summit with, as you say, a huge number of countries. More than half the world is going to be represented here. There are ministers of justice, foreign ministers, and military leaders, and so on. We have moved a long way in the last 2 years in getting the world to talk about what was a taboo subject.
People will listen to you. If you say to someone, listen to this woman's story, they will listen to you with the best one in the world, because you are Angelina Jolie. No disrespect to the fact that you're sitting next to the British Foreign Secretary, but that's how the partnership works.
What's an extraordinary thing is, you know, I can speak to these women, and a lot of these women, it's not surprising to them that I would be sitting with them, hearing their stories, and become emotional with them. But when they see the Foreign Secretary of the United Kingdom sit with them, a man, it actually means so much to them. It means maybe even more, because it is something they're not used to. So I think the power and the importance of the male role in this, the great men who protect and love women and support women, the great husbands, fathers, they have such a strong voice, and we've missed that voice. We need that voice.
I gather your own husband is here today. I can only assume he backs you up 100%.
Absolutely, yes. He's learned. So he's of course, as a husband and father, he reads these stories. He can hardly read some of these stories because he thinks about our daughter.
Angelina Jolie and William Hague speaking to the BBC's Jane Hill. Now, Australians love their slang. Barbie, tinnies, swimmers, sunnies, chunder, arvo, rack-off, ripper, dag. You get the idea. They've got loads of words that they've made up themselves. But according to the latest edition of the Dictionary of Contemporary Slang, Australianisms are on the decline. This year, fewer new Australian words than ever before managed to get into that weighty tome. Our Sydney correspondent, John Donison, has been looking back at the rise and fall of Australian slang.
Hello, all my friends in Australia. We'd like to do a song that I learned from my friend Cole Joy in Sydney about 10 years ago. And I'd like to translate, in case you don't know what the words mean.
For the untrained ear, the Australian lingo has always proved something of a challenge.
Once a jolly swagman, camped by a billabong. Now what I'm trying to say is, once a happy hobo, camped by a cool pool.
This is Johnny Cash on tour back in the day.
Under the shade of the coolibah tree. And translated, that means under the shade of the coolibah tree.
Australia has long been a country rich in slang.
Flat out like a lizard drinking.
Budgie smugglers.
Busier than a one-armed bricklayer.
Afternoon to arvo, journalist to journo.
Barbie, mate. We're all mates here, mate.
Mate. As in, you know, what the f***.
I said, do you speak my language? He just smiled and gave me a Vegemite sandwich.
Tony Thorne is the author of the Dictionary of Contemporary Slang.
Australian slang seems to have really started to build up a head of steam in the late 19th century. The people who went to Australia, especially coming from rich linguistic local traditions like Scotland and Ireland, as well as the East End of London, they were much freer, I think, to play with language in a way that the buttoned-up Brits in those days weren't able to do.
I met a strange lady, she made me nervous. She took me in and gave me breakfast.
And it was one strange lady that served up Aussie slang for a global audience. Dame Edna Everidge was at the forefront of the glory days of Australian slang in the 1970s and 80s.
You see, I'm bilingual as well. I am not only bilingual, but bi-hemispheric.
And it was one of Barry Humphrey's other screen creations, Bazza McKenzie, the hard-drinking, straight-talking Aussie abroad, that ticked all the linguistic boxes of the Australian stereotype.
I was down by Bondi Pier, drinking tubes of ice cold beer, with a bucket full of prawns upon me knee. When I swallowed the last prawn, I had a technicolor yawn, and I chucked it in the old Pacific Sea. Drink it up.
Now, though, it seems Aussie lingo is on the decline. The latest edition of Tony Thorne's Dictionary of Contemporary Slang contains just a handful of new Australianisms.
The kind of Australian culture which Australians were proud of, very macho, very classless, that kind of ochre culture is just out of date. Australia has become a powerhouse now in the financial service sector, and Australians now, when they go abroad, they're not barmen or backpackers, they're working in the corporate sector.
But politicians here are often seemingly behind the linguistic curve and have recently fallen foul of Australian slang.
Fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate. Well, again, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Can you say fair suck of the sauce bottle in Mandarin?
No, I can't. And beyond that, our good Chinese viewers will not have a clue.
Former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd seriously overdid it with the sauce during last year's election. He's about as singularly unblokey as you can get.
How many times a day do you actually shake the sauce bottle?
This is called pause for thought. Not often enough.
Here's Tony Thorne again.
We had this hilarious, to me, phenomenon where Tony Abbott, when he was in opposition, ridiculing Kevin Rudd for using what he called these old-fashioned Australianisms. Fair shake of the sauce bottle, fair suck of the pineapple. Abbott's now in power and he's using terms like fair dinkum.
In other words, you know, when a politician's using the language, it really is no longer cool. It just makes you feel a tad bit nauseous.
John Donison in Sydney. That was him doing the reporting, not doing the singing at the end. It's 3:32. Let's get the news now with Madeline Briggs.
On digital, online, smartphone and tablet. This is BBC Five Live.
You're listening to Five Live, I'm Ian Lee, and it's 3:37. Now, Walter Crompton's wife of 60 years, Eileen, has dementia and is in a care home. On a visit earlier this year, he gave her a painkiller patch. The next time he visited her, he found himself arrested, in a cell for 7 hours, and once released, only allowed to see his wife under certain conditions. For the last 2 months, he's been waiting to find out if he'll face charges. Well, he's now been told that he won't. Walter has been speaking to Five Live's Victoria Derbyshire, and she asked him how the last few months have been.
Horrendous, absolutely horrendous. Lack of sleep, loss of weight, stress. It has been a nightmare, which I've not had for so long. The only nightmare I had, well, the nightmare was when I was a child and I was from night after night in an air raid shelter, which is not with the story that we're going, but I thought that was bad enough, being protected in an air raid shelter all them years ago during the Second World War. But this has been much superior to that and much more stressful, really has.
As far as you were told, Walter, by the police and what you understood from the police, what was it they were actually investigating?
They told me on the day of the arrest that I would be arrested for applying a toxic substance to my wife in the care home, which I did apply because she was in pain and she asked me, could I relieve her arm, which is arthritic, from the pain that she was getting.
Mm. And that those painkiller patches you've used before, you've given to her before?
Enormously. When I say enormously, I mean quite a lot. Mm. Because in the years gone by, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 years, I've been administering 28 tablets a day, including codeine and other substances, which I had to do, supplied by the doctor and issued to me on weekly visits by the chemist, Bootsy's chemist. And I did what I had to do at home. Mm. Unfortunately, we couldn't get her to walk properly. She kept falling, and eventually she went into the care home for respite. I suppose it would be some sort of respite for myself as well, actually.
What do you think the police thought you were doing then?
I'm mystified, to say the least. I'm absolutely mystified. The arresting officers took a gung-ho attitude. It was like I was arrested like someone. It was like John Wayne in skirts. It was a lady, DC, and she almost intimidated me and certainly verbally abused me. I believe it to be... Well, I thought I was a very dangerous individual, and I had to be constrained by the police, but that wasn't the case. It was just I was horrified at the whole situation.
Mm. Did you get the feeling that potentially they thought you might have been trying to harm your wife?
Yes, that's what they said. That's what they did actually say to me.
Right. And how did you react to that?
Oh, with horrific feelings of what have I done? Where have I gone wrong? Am I a dangerous individual? I cannot believe what they were doing to me. They bundled me in a police van, a caged police van, took me to the police station, they took my fingerprints, DNA'd me, and bundled me in a cell for 7 hours while they ransacked my home, the police, for further pain patches, which we did have because they were there when my wife, and I had to use them on her for pain relief.
Mm. Mm. And who was it who contacted the police on that day when you administered the patch?
Yes, I don't actually know the person concerned, but...
But it was the home, was it, the care home?
Well, first and foremost, I've been told in the last few days it was social services. But then again...
How would they know?
Yes, who would contact social services? It could only be the home, couldn't it? But unfortunately, the home has been very good to my wife. They treated her very well, and they cared for her in a very nice way.
Right. Do you accept that potentially there might be someone out there who, for the right reasons, might want to help their partner, their wife, their husband with pain relief, but actually it's something that's quite specific that a care home or a nurse should really be in charge of doing?
Yes. When I first went to the care home to see her when she was first admitted, they never told me what to do or what not to do. They didn't give me any instructions whatsoever. And of course, in the following weeks, about a week later, I did, when she asked me to, give her the painkiller on her left arm, which was definitely hurting her quite a lot. And even then, it was a 5% risk because it was a lidocaine patch, and they are not dangerous. It's the morphine that they thought I'd used, the morphine patches, which are fentanyl patches, I believe, which I didn't use in the home, but I have used them at home many times when she needed the pain relief, which the doctor told me to.
How would you describe the way everybody around you seemed to react then after putting that patch on your wife's arm?
Do you mean the police?
Yeah.
The police seemed to think I was a dangerous individual. I asked myself later, where was the common sense? It would seem, I believe, that common sense is somewhat lacking in certain aspects of police guidelines. That's what I believe.
And now you can go and visit Eileen without supervision, whenever you want. Is everything back to normal, would you say?
I would say so, yes. Mm. I hope it soon dies away.
That was Walter Crompton speaking to Five Lives Victoria Derbyshire. Manchester police have defended the decision to arrest Mr. Crompton, saying it was a potentially serious incident in which a vulnerable elderly woman with significant health issues could have come to serious harm, and as such, people would expect the police to always conduct a thorough investigation. It's 3:44. Now, since its launch in the 1950s, the Brazilian version of the VW Beetle has had a special place in the nation's heart. Cheap, charismatic, and virtually indestructible, it was many Brazilians' first car and is affectionately known as the Fusca. The Fusca played a key role in the development of Brazil's economically and politically vital national car industry. The BBC's Candice Piet has been speaking to two Fusca fans.
Vou no meu Fusca azul, todo mundo está olhando, lá vai eu e a Maurilu, Many countries have a little car with a big place in their heart. For the English, it's the Austin Mini. For Italians, it's the Cinquecento. And for Brazilians, it's the Fusca. Fusca was the nickname for the version of the VW Beetle, made in Brazil.
It was my first car. I was still a teenager. Mine was light blue. My dad bought it for me. At the time, my friends who had any car had that.
Cílio Bocanera is the London correspondent for Brazil's Globo News. He got his first Fusca in Rio de Janeiro in the 1960s.
It was a car that represented something. The chance to take the girls out, get out of the city, go away for the weekend. A lot of your friends didn't have the car, so you had to try to squeeze as many people as possible. And ventilation was horrendous. Summer in Rio, it gets, you know, about 40 degrees. 40 degrees inside that oven called the Fusca. It's something you never forget.
The first Fuscas rolled off Brazilian production lines in the 1950s. The government had decided to copy the United States by paving its huge country with roads and trying to develop a car industry to meet demand. The most popular product by far was Volkswagen's little Fusca. It appealed not just to well-off Rio families like Cílio's, but Brazilians of every class.
I liked the Fusca because it was cheap and because it had personality. I was only 11 when I started saving up for my dream of having my own car to drive when I turned 18.
Edivaldo Fernandes was probably destined to own a Fusca. His father worked in one of the factories near São Paulo that used to make them. And like Cílio, his first one was blue.
I actually got my car when I was 16 and spent 2 years working on it before I got my license. I knew I could jazz it up pretty cheaply. It was Atlantic blue, and I got a Porsche supplier to put in Porsche rear lights, remote control door systems, and neon panels. And when I actually turned 18, the car was ready. I didn't really use it, though. I just took it out to show off.
And what did people think of it?
As mulheres adoravam, mas nessa época eu já namorava minha esposa já, né? Então
women loved it. But I was already going out with a woman who would become my wife. I only had eyes for her. She helped me choose all the colors and accessories, and she fell in love with the Fusca when she was working on it with me.
Moro num país tropical, abençoado por Deus e bonito por natureza.
Not only did the Fusca have personality, its reliability made it the practical choice for Brazil. It could be used for any job, from driving lessons,
autoescola, tem que ser Volkswagen,
to hire cars,
auto aluguel do tipo dirija você mesmo. A maioria absoluta é Volkswagen.
Tenho um Fusca e um violão, sou Flamengo, tenho uma nega chamada Teresa.
Você acaba aprendendo na prática, realmente exercitando.
I found it pretty easy to learn mechanics on that car by just making it up as I went along. You didn't need a teacher.
Pois eu sou feliz, muito feliz, comigo mesmo.
One time we did a road trip to the Iguazu waterfalls, then Argentina, then Paraguay in a Fusca, and we got back in one piece.
The Fusca was so reliable that it was even used by the police during Brazil's military rule in the 60s, 70s and 80s. Brazilians gave that model of the car a more ominous nickname.
Their cars used to get called the cockroach because they were dark and round. The police used the cars to move around and carry prisoners. People used to stare at them in fright.
By the late 1970s, the Brazilian car industry was becoming a key driver of the economy. The industrial outskirts of Greater São Paulo had become a vast sprawl of factories, supplying not just Brazil, but much of South America.
And at that time, they imported a lot of labor from the northeast of Brazil, a poor part of the country, including a man who had to learn to operate machinery. His name was Lula da Silva.
So you've got all these people who've come down to work in this new industry, churning out millions of cars. You also got a new political awareness developing, didn't you? We're in the heart of the military dictatorship at the time, but then suddenly something starts to grow in these factories.
When the 70s came, the unions started to organize around Lula. And he was jailed, as was almost automatic. But the movement started to grow. And that was, we could say, the seeds of protests that led to pressure for the military government to get out.
Democracy returned to Brazil in 1985. Volkswagen tried to replace the Fusca with a new generation of vehicles.
O Fusquinha volta ao mercado valendo aproximadamente $7,200.
But in 1993, the plucky little car made an unexpected comeback. President Itamar Franco was a Fusca fan, and he wanted to see them on a Brazilian production line again.
The second civilian president of Brazil put pressure on Volkswagen in Germany to manufacture again the old Fusca. He had such an attachment to that car that Volkswagen went ahead and produced it for a while, but the technology hadn't moved on.
By that time, Edivaldo Fernandes was working at the same VW factory as his father, so he was there to watch the Fusca's final farewell.
I tried to get into the official ceremony for the last Fusca, but it was just for celebrities, so I had to watch it from a long way off. But I was there when the last Fusca came off the line. We had to give the car a second funeral.
Today, the car industry is as vital as ever in Brazil. It's booming. With cheap credit and more prosperity, many Brazilian cities and motorways are constantly gridlocked with traffic. Edivaldo Fernandes still works nights at the Volkswagen factory, but he spends much of his free time organizing Fusca events.
Parte que a gente participava de eventos, né, os encontros de carros antigos.
Now my wife comes with me to all the collectors' shows and vintage car rallies, and she knows all about the different models and everything.
And how many Fuscas do you have?
Fusca, hoje a gente tem seis.
We have six.
And how many children?
Duas menininhas.
Two little girls.
More Fuscas than children, then.
Yes, and the cars don't answer back.
And how do people react nowadays when they see a Fusca on the road?
Tantos carros modernos.
It's funny. There are lots of modern cars out there, but when a Fusca goes by, everybody stops and stares. The kids love it. They say, "Look, Daddy, there's a Fusca." People just can't take their eyes off them.
Candice Piet there reporting on the Brazilian car, the Fusca. It's 3:53.
Across the UK.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live. Up all night.
Now, four new choral works commemorating World War I will be performed for the first time at the National Portrait Gallery in London later today. Inspired in part by portraits from the war, the pieces also draws heavily on the gallery's own records of how staff coped as Zeppelins brought the war to the British mainland. The BBC's Chris Vallance has been to rehearsals.
Let nobody be under the misapprehension that flying in a Zeppelin was something very comfortable. As a matter of fact, for the attacking aircraft, a Zeppelin of that size was a sitting target.
A Zeppelin crew member recalls the perils of World War I. The National Portrait Gallery has commissioned four new choral pieces based in part on life in the gallery when the air war came to London.
I'm Gregory Batsler, and I'm the Artistic Director of the National Portrait Gallery's Choir in Residence programme.
And this is the Portrait Choir. What is the Portrait Choir?
And the Portrait Choir is a group of young professional singers who come from throughout the UK about six times a year to perform programmes in the gallery where we explore some of the collection through choral music, and we explore some of the themes and the vast wealth of inspiration we have in the National Portrait Gallery.
In the archives of the gallery, boxes and boxes of paper records produced by museum staff during the war provided raw material for the compositions. Bryony Millen is the gallery's archivist.
Well, the gallery closed to the public in November 1915, and the remaining staff were sworn in as special constables, gentlemen of a slightly advanced age, shall we say. So this is the National Portrait Gallery Special Constabulary Report Book. We have all of the recording that the warders do of what they see, what they observe from the roof. So they're observing these new threats, they're seeing zeppelins, they are seeing planes, they are seeing fires breaking out across London from their vantage point.
So here we are. So if you read from the relevant bit, temporary attendant Wall, who arrived on duty at 1:15, reported that he was at Liverpool Street Station about 11:40, where great damage was done and many people killed and injured. He himself narrowly escaped death or injury from a bomb which exploded about 50 yards from him, but a woman standing near was truncated. Truncated, what a horrid word.
I know, it's quite gruesome, isn't it? An horrific thought.
The works also draw inspiration from a current exhibition, The Great War in Portraits. Curator Paul Morehouse took me to an image that seemingly didn't have any people in it at all.
This is a colour photograph by Jules Gervais Courtelmont, a French photographer, and it depicts the shattered, devastated landscape of northern France with blasted trees and the earth looks as though it's been turned over by an earthquake. People say to me, why is this landscape in an exhibition of portraits? And my response is, well, this landscape is full of people. It appears empty, but actually it's full of people. The terrible tragedy is that they are all part of the earth on which they were fighting and have now been atomized.
James Burton is one of the four composers who wrote for the performance. This piece combines text from the gallery's archive with older themes.
The atmosphere that I was interested by was the idea of the blackout. I had no idea that in World War One there was the blackout was enforced. And when I was a young boy, I sang in a choir, and one of the hymns that we used to sing at the evensong service is Te Lucis Ante Terminum, which is an ancient Gregorian melody. Before the ending of the day, creator of the world, we pray that with thy wonted favour thou wouldst be our guard and keeper now. And of course, the people who were here were the guards and the keepers of the collection during this period.
The gallery itself will be the venue for the performances. When I visited, it was filled with primary school children gabbering over their work, looked down on by Lawrences and Waltons. A happier sound for a happier time, perhaps.
And I looked up and I saw that this zeppelin had been picked out by the searchlights. Then there was a small glow which gradually spread the whole length. And afterwards the thing burst into one big conflagration. And as it came down, very, very slowly, I heard my mother say, oh, those poor men up there. But there was an old Boer War veteran next door who said, let them fizzle.
Chris Valance there reporting on four new choral works commemorating World War One being performed for the first time at the National Portrait Gallery in London later on today. And if you're lucky enough to be going to that, I'm sure it's going to be a particularly powerful experience to hear that. We've got another hour left of Up All Night. It's 3:59. I'm Ian Lee. If you've just tuned in, well, you've missed a lot in the first few hours, but as I say, we've got another 60 minutes to come.
Coming up next on 5 Live.
After four, the former US Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, warns that America shouldn't send ground troops back to Iraq. Brazil beat Croatia 3-1 in the first game of the World Cup as protests continue in Rio and Sao Paulo. And we're live at the biggest video game trade show in the world, the Electronic Entertainment Expo in Los Angeles.
This is BBC Five Live, the home of Brazil 2014.
It's 4 o'clock on Five Live. I'm Ian Lee, and this is Up All Night. It's 6 minutes past four. I'm Ian Lee, and this is Up All Night. And the World Cup in Brazil has officially started. What did you make of the opening ceremony? Trees on stilts and children with balls tied to their legs seem to be the order of the day, along with a performance by J-Lo that many suspect had the same sound guy as the one that worked on Jamaica Inn. But what of the football? Was the opening match any good? Well, we'll have more on that in a little bit. But first, President Obama says that the United States is examining all options to stop Islamist insurgents heading for the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. The Iraqi government has deployed its air force to attack jihadists from the al-Qaeda-linked ISIS group, but its militants still control the cities of Tikrit and Mosul and are now fighting for control of large swathes of the country. Patrick Coburn is the independent newspaper's Iraq correspondent. I asked him first to explain what's been happening on the ground in northern Iraq today.
The Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, this extreme outfit which has conquered much of northern Iraq, continues to advance. They avowed that they're going to take Baghdad and then move on the Shia cities of the south. They say that their own victories can only be explained by divine intervention. They don't show any sign of stopping.
Who are ISIS, and what exactly do they want? Do they want to take over all of Iraq?
Yes, ISIS grew out of al-Qaeda in Iraq, which has fought the Americans, but above all fought the Shia. It's an extremely bigoted organization. It believes in fundamentalist Islam, which means Sharia law. It means the subjugation of women. It means that heretics, that Christians and Shia and anybody who differs from them is regarded as a heretic. Their method of responding to almost anything is violence.
The militants have seized the cities of Mosul and Tikrit, and they already have western cities like Ramadi. But what exactly does that mean? How much of the country do they control?
They probably control around 15%. That doesn't mean a lot because Iraqis tend to be concentrated in cities on the rivers, on the Euphrates and Tigris. They're big areas of salt marsh and desert. But they've taken two big cities, Mosul and Tikrit. They've moved into others. But what's so extraordinary about the present situation is that the Iraqi government had 900,000 men under arms, one of the bigger armies in the world. They had $100 billion a year in oil revenue to arm these soldiers. And this whole army has sort of evaporated and fled before forces that are much weaker than itself.
Why have they done that? Because there are only a few thousand of these militants, and you say that it's a huge Iraqi army, and yet they seem to have just put down their guns and run away.
Well, I can give you various reasons, but I'm still amazed by it. I mean, it's enormous. It's a kind of patronage machine. In other words, it was sort of jobs for the boys. Particularly if you were a Shia and you wanted a job, you joined the army. You certainly drew a salary. There may have been 900,000 jobs, but I don't know how many of them ever actually turned up. Many of some of the units that were fighting in Anbar, one of the Sunni provinces earlier in the year, people were complaining that there were meant to be 700 men in a unit, and only there were only about 150. They were complaining that money for food and fuel was all embezzled by the officers. If you wanted to become a divisional commander, it could cost you maybe a couple of $1 million. And then you'd make that back through protection rackets and kickbacks from the checkpoints on the roads, who would extort money from vehicles, I mean cars and trucks going past.
And what about the Americans? What options do they have? Because it could be argued that part of this problem has happened because the Americans have got no presence there at all anymore.
Yeah, but the Iraqis didn't want them to have any presence. I mean, this has been brought up now as if this was something that, you know, Obama had withdrawn, but he withdrew because they couldn't agree with the Iraqi government to have anybody remaining there. And, you know, they negotiated for quite a long time. It's not that this sort of happened by accident or it was all a decision taken in the White House. But it's also difficult, you know, what exactly would the Americans do? Training? Well, you know, that hasn't worked too well, looking at the Iraqi army. It's a toxic idea in America to intervene in Iraq or Syria. Obviously, the American people don't want it. And the only thing probably would do any good would be providing air cover to the Iraqi army.
Do you think that's a possibility, drone strikes, things like that?
Not really, no. I don't think it would make much difference unless it was an absolutely massive intervention, and I don't feel that that's politically possible.
Well, that's the Iraq correspondent for The Independent, Patrick Coburn, speaking to me earlier on. And in an exclusive interview with the BBC's Newsnight, Mrs. Clinton told Jeremy Paxman that military action was not a role for the US.
I agree with the White House's rejection and reluctance to do the kind of military activities that the Maliki government is requesting, namely fighter aircraft to provide close support for the army and also to go after targets. That is not a role for the United States. There needs to be a number of steps that Maliki and his government must take to demonstrate that he's committed to an inclusive Iraq, something he has not done up to date. The army, which has not been able to hold territory, has to have an injection of discipline and professionalism, something the United States has been trying to help with. And Maliki has to be willing to demonstrate unequivocally that he is a leader for all Iraqis, not for a sectarian slice of the country.
But the White House is saying that no option is ruled out.
That's what they should say, because part of what they're trying to do...
But you think they should rule some things out?
At this time, I said. Mm. At this time, yes, because the conditions precedent have not been accepted or set by Maliki. And I think what the White House is doing now is making it very clear to him what they would have to see, and not saying that they would necessarily provide the kind of support he's asking for, but the sort of support that the United States believes would be appropriate.
But it would be inappropriate to send in ground forces of any kind.
Yes, that is not going to happen.
Never, under any circumstances.
Well, I mean, I never say never, because one doesn't know. The world is so unpredictable, but certainly not at, in any foreseeable future that I'm aware of.
When you look at what's happening in Iraq, do you feel guilty that you supported the invasion?
Well, as I say in my book, I made a mistake giving the Bush administration and the authority that I voted for. It was not used as I had expected it to be used, and the entire implementation strategy was flawed. So, yes, I made a mistake, and I deeply regret the consequences.
Because that country wasn't broken before the invasion,
was
it?
Oh, it was broken. It was a broken country, even though it had a dictator who could, by force and brutality, hold it together. But remember, he'd also invaded Kuwait, and he had gassed the Kurds. He was no shining example of sovereignty and territorial integrity.
No one suggests he was a nice guy.
Well, he was worse than not a nice guy. But that is not the debate. The debate now is, you know, it was done. The invasion occurred. He was deposed. The Iraqi people were given a chance to chart a different course. Some of them have done quite well, like the Kurds in the north have done extremely well. But the government that came in through the elections, which were deemed internationally acceptable, has not done what it needed to do to try to unify the country, bring Sunni and Shiite alike, bring the different factions within together.
Compare Iraq, where there was intervention, with Syria, where there was no intervention.
Just shows you how hard it is to make these choices, which is why I'm calling the book Hard Choices. Because I did advocate for limited but focused action in Syria to try to vet, train, and equip moderate opponents of Assad.
And you were overruled by the president.
I was overruled, in part because of the lessons from Iraq. It's hard to get a little bit pregnant, so to speak, in being involved in these countries' internal conflicts, but I did think there was a potential role. Now, of course, what I say in the book was a wicked problem has become even wickeder.
How much was that decision not to get involved in Syria influenced by the fact that the British Parliament held that surprising vote not to have any military intervention?
I'm sure that influenced it because that vote was some days prior to the president having to make a final decision. And it was there was a series of votes, as I recall, what happened in the British Parliament. Yeah. And the individual votes were defeated, but if you had added up all the votes for everything that would have been a positive, you could have gotten to that. But for all kinds of reasons, and I don't pretend to understand the intricacies of British politics or British parliamentary procedure, it was a defeat for the idea that there should be intervention.
And that influenced the American decision not to intervene.
I believe it did. I was out of office by then, but it's my understanding that it certainly was taken into account.
That was the former US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton speaking to the BBC's Newsnight programme. It's 4:16. The Football World Cup has begun in Brazil with a lavish opening ceremony in Sao Paulo.
One night watch the world unite, two sides, one fight and a million eyes. Full heart's gonna work so hard, shoot all the stars, be sprays
up. Well, it's good to know that Pitbull was there. The build-up, though, has been overshadowed by protests against the huge cost, as well as controversy over alleged corruption in football's world governing body, FIFA. Yesterday, there were clashes between police and protesters on the world-famous Copacabana beach, as Up All Night's Tim Vickery told me earlier.
There are clashes, or certainly the potential for clashes, out there between a group of protesters and the police, the group of protesters in the vicinity of the TV studios, and the police have prevented them from storming those TV studios. You can probably hear the helicopters in the background at the moment, and it's yet more examples of perhaps the public relations disaster that this 2014 World Cup is, with a significant proportion of Brazilian society.
There have also been protests in Sao Paulo. They were witnessed by the BBC's Richard Conway.
From just driving through the centre of Sao Paulo tonight, it does appear to be calm, but that certainly wasn't the case this morning. And early this afternoon, I was out near the subway station in the east of the city, near to the stadium, area called Carau, where a small group of protesters, it was around about 200, 250 in number, had gathered to stage a protest. Within minutes of that getting underway, it was peaceful. The police went straight in. There were stun grenades, tear gas, rubber bullets, and they pursued the protesters up the street. And that sparked a series of running skirmishes throughout the day through those streets, and with police taking absolutely no chances at all in terms of a risk of the protesters trying to get to the stadium and making it a disturbance around the stadium tonight. No chance taken whatsoever with that.
But the violence didn't stop the action on the pitch. Brazil won in Sao Paulo, beating Croatia 3-1. Five Live's Conor McNamara watched the game in Rio.
I guess that there is a huge amount of pressure on Brazil, and you could see the emotion in the players as they came out the tunnel at the start, and they lined up for the anthems, and you know they've been waiting for this for a long, long time. They've known that they'd be the host, they know that they would have the centre stage of the world football looking at them, and the pressure of the country on them. And I guess when you look at it in those terms, it's no surprise that Brazil got off to a little bit of a shaky start. But don't forget, 4 years ago, Spain lost their opening game and went on to win the World Cup. So for Brazil, it's not been that bad tonight. They recovered. I think they were helped out quite considerably by a refereeing decision in their favour. But they've got that first win underway, and I bet you we will see them now in a more relaxed fashion when they play their next game.
They had a couple of referee decisions go their own way. A yellow card was presented when perhaps the player could have been sent off, and of course they had that controversial penalty.
Yeah, the penalty particularly is the one that's going to be highlighted around the world. And this is the trouble when you do have the spotlight in the world. You know, these things will be noticed. The referee's from Japan. He has been involved in World Cups before. And I know that, you know, there was comments earlier on this season in with Manchester City in the Champions League. And Manuel Pellegrini was not pleased that a referee from Sweden was taking charge of a Champions League game, saying that the quality of football that he's in charge in week in, week out in the Swedish league wouldn't be up to Champions League standard. I think the Croatians will have a similar sort of comment to make about domestic football in Japan, and are the referees used to making the big decisions?
Brazil obviously won. Neymar had a great game, stole the show, but they weren't as strong and as confident and as fluid as when they were playing in the Confederations Cup last year, were they?
Well, no, as I said in the first answer, I think it's the pressure of hosting your World Cup. I mean, they've known about this for a long, long time now. And you know, some of these guys, since they've been teenagers, they'll have had, you know, an ambition to be involved in this World Cup and to represent Brazil. And that has to bring a huge amount of pressure with it. I think Brazil finished the game much more strongly than they started. I think once they get into their second, third matches of the tournament, that's perhaps when we'll see them at their best. But, you know, if you're going to rate them against the top, top teams that we've seen over the years, Spain 4 years ago, their own Brazilian variations back through the down through the years, I think the jury is still out as to whether this Brazil side are absolutely top class. Of course, they're up there amongst the favourites, but they're going to have to play better than they did tonight if they're going to win the World Cup.
Connor, what's happening tomorrow? What can we look forward to?
Well, I'm in Salvador, where we've got what's probably, certainly on paper anyway, the game of the group stages. We've got a replay of what was the final last time round, Spain against the Netherlands. That was a very close final, if you remember. There was red cards shown. Spain won it by just a goal to nil, Andreas Iniesta. And I'm sure over the last 4 years, those Dutch players, you know, first thing in the morning, every morning when they wake up, they will be thinking of that game. That was their chance to become world champions. The Dutch have been to 3 World Cup finals. They've never won one. And you just wonder, you know, is the chance going to come for them again this time around? It's a vastly different squad. If you compare the Spanish squad that won in South Africa 4 years ago, 16 of the players are still involved in the 23 this time around. For the Dutch, it's only 7. So there's a lot of young legs who've come in, but who don't have the international experience. Of course, they've got Louis van who's about to take over at Manchester United, and this will be his swan song for his country. He's won big. He's won league titles with every club he's been involved with, Van Gaal. He's not had the success yet with the Dutch. He'd love to go out on a high. And what's interesting is, particularly because of injury, they've had to adjust their system. I mean, traditionally, the Dutch always go 4-3-3. They've had to adjust their system. They're going to play with 5 defenders. And this is going to be interesting to see how they smother Spain, who, you know, we think will go with this false 9 system. They won't play an out-and-out striker. Cesc Fabregas will play that central attacking role. And with these 5 defenders and holding midfielders, I think it tactically, it's going to be a really interesting game to watch. And it doesn't necessarily mean it'll be negative and dull from the Dutch, because anyone who saw Real Madrid and how they won the Champions League, they defended very deep, holding midfielders in front of the back 4. But then when they went on the counter-attack and guys like Bale and Ronaldo had the pace, that's where they were very exciting to watch. And I think that's what the Dutch will hope to recreate with the likes of Ian Robin doing the breaking, the counter-attacking play and trying to catch the Spanish out. So I think it's going to be a really intriguing game.
Yeah, should be an exciting game. Also got Mexico versus Cameroon, of course, and Chile versus Australia. Any news, Connor, on England's preparations for their game against Italy on Saturday?
I think for England, you know, we speak about the pressure the Brazilians are under. I actually think for the first time in a long time, there isn't a massive, massive expectancy pressure on England. I thought it would turn up a notch over the last few weeks, and it hasn't quite done so. I mean, I know people have been very impressed with Ross Barkley, and rightly so. He's looked fantastic. But people aren't getting carried away about England the way they usually do, and I think that's going to help the players. They can relax a little bit. They don't feel that any little mistake they made, they're going to end up in a pizza company advert. And I think that just might work out going in England's favour. But getting off to a good start is going to be absolutely huge. Everything we've heard is that the pitch is poor up in Manaus. But, you know, the Italians will have to play on that pitch as well. And I think if England can get a win, that'll really settle nerves down and win this one, and I think they will go through out of the group. However, lose it, and then they're playing catch-up immediately. So although it is just the first game, and this is the thing, you know, you compare a World Cup to a Premier League season. A Premier League season, you can have an off weekend. You can even have 2 or 3 of them over the season. You can still win the league. At a World Cup, you can't have a bad 10 minutes. You know, you could have a bad 10 minutes at a World Cup. You would have a player sent off. You would have maybe 2 goals conceded, and you're out of the World Cup. So those are the pressures the players are under. I think if England get off to a good start against Italy, who knows, they can. I mean, realistically, they're not going to go and win it. They're not going to get to the semi-finals. But I think England can get out of this group if they get a good start against Italy.
That was Connor McNamara speaking to me earlier after Brazil won the opening match of the World Cup. Now, Michael Booker is the night editor of The Express. Earlier I spoke to him and he began by telling me about the dangers of red meat.
Well, it's a study that's been done in Scandinavia, and it's the first study to see the difference between the effects of processed red meat, like bacon, ham, sausages, obviously it's barbecue season, and unprocessed stuff such as steak and meat. Now, what it is, it's findings from questionnaires over a few years of 37,000 men, so it's quite a wide-ranging study for these sort of things.
Yeah.
And what they've discovered is that eating just a small amount of the processed red meat every day can send you to an early grave. Oh. So it's not exactly cheerful. Just having a rasher or two of bacon or a couple of slices of ham can raise the risk of dying from heart failure by more than a third, according to this study.
Michael, this is interesting to me because I've been a vegetarian for the last 25 years.
Blimey.
I know. I've just in the last 2 months started eating meat.
Ah.
And now you're telling me that bacon, the bacon that I'm loving so much is going to kill me.
Well, if you weigh it out, you may stand a chance because the current guidelines, they say you can have 70 grams of processed meat.
Right.
Or two or three slices of bacon a day. But the study found that those people who had, say, 75 grams a day or more were twice as likely to die from heart failure. So the advice is to, at the moment, keep away from that sort of stuff. Oh. The good news is the unprocessed stuff, steak, things like that, that didn't have a big impact as far as the study's concerned. So, stick to the probably the more expensive stuff.
Is there some way that we could argue that steak is actually good for you?
I think we can. In a backhanded way with this. It's not bad, so it's good.
Hey, listen, one of the big stories for the last few days is the situation in Iraq. How are you covering that?
Well, it does seem to have crept up very quickly over the last couple of days. And obviously, if you're out there, you've probably been reading the runes and seeing this coming. But I think as far as the British media is concerned, it has all of a sudden, and the speed of this, the way the militants, this group called ISIS, which is seem to have come out of Syria, and a lot of radicalized fighters from there are now fighting in Iraq, and they've obviously taken quite a few cities and oil refineries. And just one of the strands of the stories we're doing in today's paper is that it looks as though already that's going to have a knock-on effect on the price of petrol. So straight away, obviously there's a humanitarian effect out there on the people who are having to go through this horrible, horrible time. Over here, we've got the effect of petrol prices look as though they're going to be soaring. We spoke to the RSC. Their spokesman said the worsening situation there is causing a knee-jerk reaction in the global fuel market. And it's going to go up a couple of pence already on Wednesday and Thursday. And you know, with these things, where they go is that the worse it gets, the higher the prices.
Mm.
The second strand to it is we've got a comment piece by one of our commentators, Stephen Pollard, just looking at, again, there isn't an appetite particularly for us to get involved. We were involved from 2003. Many of our boys died out there, and people are thinking, well, we don't want to get involved again. But you're just making the point that if you think this has got nothing to do with us, just look at what happened on May the 24th at the Jewish Museum in Brussels, where four people were killed. The guy's going on trial, but it's believed that the guy was thought to be responsible. He came back from Syria after fighting with ISIS, and he's making the point that, look, they hate Assad just as much as they hate us as well. So there's a lot of these people being radicalized in Syria. A lot of them are finding their way to Europe, and we've got to be very, very careful.
Slightly more upbeat note. Have you got World Cup fever at the Express, Michael?
Well, I'm not particularly good myself because I count myself as Scottish, having been born there. So I always look at these World Cups with a little bit of a harum thing as England build themselves up to successful.
Listen, I'm half Scottish, but I still you have to support England, don't you?
I've never ever supported England in anything, and I'll probably get beaten up on the street later on for this. But I don't know, I've always had that chip on my shoulder about it, but I'm getting into the swing of things. We've got it on the front page, we've got it on page 2 and 3 as well. We've had last night's opening ceremony.
What did you make of the opening ceremony?
Well, it's easy to criticise, and we've got a bit of the criticism. Obviously, people on Twitter these days, it is going to be a big social media World Cup, and people were very quick to say, oh, this is rubbish, we can't hear J-Lo. But when you just look at the people actually in the stadium, there was a carnival atmosphere there. These things are always unnecessary. I think particularly in football, these opening ceremonies where people are dressed as trees, giant footballs.
There were trees on stilts, weren't there?
Trees on stilts. But I suppose if you're doing one of these opening ceremonies, you've got to give it some. So, hats off to them in that way. There was criticism. It did look very nice. Brazil then kicked things off by scoring an own goal, which was fantastic. Mm. But our man in Manaus, just away from where the opening ceremony was, where England are going to be playing on Saturday, noticing, and there's some pictures of ground staff there, and there has been some criticism of the state of the pitch, looking a little bit yellow, and it appeared, and the pictures seem to show them spraying something green onto the yellow bits.
No. So
hopefully it's not just paint, hopefully some sort of fertilizer or something, something that
They're spray painting the pitch to make it more green, like a bald man using mane or something.
We haven't studied what the substance is. We haven't got that close to it yet, but it certainly looks that way. So it does look slightly farcical, but these things always work out in the end, don't they?
They do. Our Olympics was always very last minute, and these things tend to be fine in the end.
But it's the lovely phony newspaper war where these great stories are just before actually anyone starts kicking balls around.
That's Michael Booker, night editor of The Express. It's 4:33 exactly. Let's get the news now with Madeleine Briggs.
On digital, online, smartphone and tablet, this is BBC Five Live.
Hello, this is Ian Lee, 4:40, up all night here for another 20 minutes. Now, E3 has drawn to a close and the booths are being packed away even as we speak. For you non-gamers, let me explain. It's the Electronic Entertainment Expo in Los Angeles and it's the biggest video game trade show in the world. Here's one of the more dramatic moments.
I distinctly remember saying, stop the bus. Yes, stop the bus. Not shoot the bus. I'm very particular with my words. Stop. Shoot. Stop. Shoot. Do those words sound the same?
That it got out of control.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. What'd you say?
It got out of control.
Got out of control. I hate when things get out of control.
Oh dear, that didn't sound very pleasant, did it? It's the latest in the Far Cry series. And during the Xbox presentation, it was one of the smaller games that caught our producer Adam's eye. That's Ori and the Blind Forest. We can chat now to two men who are no doubt resting their weary thumbs in LA hotel rooms. Sam Clay, the video editor for Video Game 24/7, and Nick Cowan, games editor at large for T3 magazine and also works for The Guardian. Sam, let's start with you. What games caught your eye this year?
Hello. Well, how many games? So many. Evolve. Definitely caught my eye as a fan of Left 4 Dead, a series of four-player co-op game. It's their next game, and essentially four friends get together and they take on a big old monster. So that's pretty much.
For those who don't know, Left 4 Dead had you and three of your mates basically running around a place that had been taken over by zombies. Is this kind of similar to it?
In the sense that you're now in a place that's been taken over by deadly wildlife and a big dinosaur that's about to kill you as well.
Sounds perfect. Nick, what caught your eye?
What caught my eye was Batman Arkham Knight. I'm a huge fan of the Arkham series, and to tell you the truth, it's amazing to see such an incredible franchise taken widescreen. In this one, Batman's essentially... You as Batman are placed in Gotham City, where you have free reign of it, not just by gliding through the rooftops, but also driving through it in the Batmobile. It's an incredibly impressive piece of work. It really is.
I'm a big fan. Listen, let me put my cards on the table. I'm a gamer as well. I'm a big fan of the Batman games. But one thing that's upset me about video games in the last few years, Nick, is the number of sequels. There are very few kind of new games. They're all sequels and follow-ons, aren't they?
I would say yes and no. Obviously, there's going to be sequels just because, you know, as they say in Hollywood, the last sequel to get made is the one that doesn't make any money. And obviously, these massive games publishers want a constant stream of revenue coming in. So if any game that they make makes money, if any game that they make is successful, obviously want to capitalize on that and give people more of what they want. By the same token, however, what was great about this year's E3 is the massive amounts of new games that were coming out. You had Sunset Overdrive, you had Evolve, you know, you had a ton of new IP coming down the line. And I think that, you know, in actual fact, and this is going to sound like a soundbite, but you know, there's never been a better time to be in video games because you have, you know, these incredible franchises that obviously loads and loads of people love. But by the same token, you have a ton of new IP coming at you at the same time.
And Sam, the consoles we've got at the moment are the best, obviously, they've ever been, with the Xbox One, the PlayStation 4. Are we really starting to see the full potential of those machines yet?
Well, actually, this year we got to see a lot of games on those platforms that just look just amazing. There's a moment in the Ubisoft conference where I actually had to kind of pinch myself for the Assassin's Creed game and Far Cry 4, where it actually looked so realistic. It was unbelievable. We're so close to the boundary of real life, it's quite worrying. Graphically.
Nick, for those who don't know, the only games convention I've been to was the Tokyo Game Show. This is even bigger than that. Why is E3 so important?
E3 is important because it's essentially where the entire games industry congregates. And it's one of those reasons where you say to yourself, well, why is it held any other place other than LA? Well, LA is the nexus point. You have all the developers on the Western Seaboard. It's halfway between Europe and Japan. Everyone congregates here. It's the halfway point, basically, between the gaming world.
But what a lot of people may not know is that Britain is one of the forerunners in games development. It has been since the 1980s, with the kids writing games in their bedrooms. Were we well represented over there?
Sorry, was that aimed at me or Sam?
You, Nick.
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, you know, one of the biggest announcements that was made at Sony's keynote, for example, was the fact that Grand Theft Auto 5 is finally coming to next gen. And as anyone who knows about Grand Theft Auto, it's a titan in the video games industry, and that is British made.
Sam, we're talking about all the big games and all the big companies. Were there any, were small independents being represented there?
Plenty of them. So each of the console manufacturers, Sony and Xbox, have really got behind the independents. And in fact, we're kind of just like throwing numbers about, saying we've got 80 independents on our console. Here are what they're making. And actually, they made a really big thing about these indie game developers. And a lot of their games, to be honest with you, looked fascinating, more colourful than anything we'd seen before. And even Sony really dedicated a good 10-15 minute slot of their big conference to an indie title.
Well, listen, I'm deeply envious that both of you went there, and I'm stuck in a tiny little studio without any windows. But thank you very much. Thank you for the update. That was Sam Clay, video editor for Video Game 24/7, and Nick Cowan from Games Editor at Large for T3 Magazine, and he also works for The Guardian. It's 4:47.
On DAB Digital Radio, digital TV, downloads and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live. Up all night.
I'm not jealous in the slightest. Now for the latest news from Nigeria with the Lagos-based journalist Chris Iwoka. I asked him first about reports of a ban on public screenings of football matches in the north of the country.
In fact, as we speak, yes, in northern Nigeria, especially in the state of Adamawa, where there was an attack not too long ago in a pub, a drinking pub, which was screening a football match. And there are fears that the insurgents in the northeast of Nigeria, Boko Haram, might use the opportunity of the current World Cup to target some viewing centers. Of course, this will not be the first time they had targeted that of Adamawa. And again, they also targeted another one in Jos, but it was a suicide bomb attack that was foiled. Now, the fear in the heart of the government, especially the security agencies, is that the Boko Haram might just target a crowd of people, because they consider that viewing centers also sell alcohol, and this they feel is against Islam. But beyond that, there have been a lot of attacks in recent times. In Jos, in central Nigeria, there have been attacks where at least 8 people were killed. There had been other attacks in several other parts of the northeast, especially some villages in Borno area. And the World Cup now on, and Nigeria being a great footballing nation, and indeed lots of football fans all over the country. Nigeria is also participating in the World Cup anyway. And so the expectation that a lot of people will crowd into these viewing centers. And so to forestall any possibility of an attack on such centers, the ban has to be put put in place by the state agencies.
And as you say, Nigeria, is it? It loves football. How are people reacting to that?
Well, it dampens a lot of spirit. People are really not happy about it. But again, it appears that they are taking it with some sense of responsibility, as people are now feeling that they need to also take responsibility for their own security. And so they have to be cautious where they gather or where they go. Of course, next Monday, Nigeria will be playing its first match against Iran. And a lot of people are expecting to meet with friends in a viewing center or possibly a pub, a drinking pub, where over glasses of wine they could be watching and commenting on the game. But again, with the security situation in the country, it's not going to, it appears, the luxury of that conviviality of comradeship of friends watching football together may not be there, and many people are really not happy about it.
Well, yeah, that would be a great shame to miss out on that. Still on Insecurity, Hollywood star Angelina Jolie and British Foreign Secretary William Hague are holding a summit on ending sexual violence in war. Over 200 schoolgirls, of course, abducted from Chibok in northeast Nigeria, yet to be released, and there are indications that they may be raped.
In fact, that is the dark cloud hanging over Nigeria as it is right now. The Chibok girls, about 200 of them, are still in custody of the abductors, Boko Haram, somewhere in the northeast of Nigeria, and have not been released. And at the meeting in London, there had been another meeting at the verge, at the sidelines, according to the reports, hosted by the Foreign Secretary, William Hague, with foreign ministers of not just Nigeria, but Cameroon, Niger, Mali, and Benin Republic over this issue of Boko Haram. The issue of Boko Haram attack, as well as sexual violence, is something that has echoed, especially for those that have fought wars. And Nigeria currently, according to the president, said Nigeria is in a state of war with Boko Haram. So the fears that these Boko Haram members may, now having this over 200 schoolgirls between age 14 and 16 in their custody, and could subject them to some form of rape, is very, very strong here. And the government, although said everything is being done to rescue them, what I can say is that there had been a lot of protests going on urging the government to do something to rescue the girls. But up till now, the efforts of the government is yet to see the light of day. And this is, again, part of the effect of the ongoing insurgency by members of the Boko Haram that has also killed lots of people, not just in the northeast of Nigeria, but also attacked Abuja, the capital of Nigeria.
Now, the governor of the Bank of England has surprised many in the financial world by hinting that interest rates could rise much sooner than expected, perhaps even by the end of this year. It's Mark Carney's strongest hint yet that rates could rise for the first time in more than 5 years, from their historic low of 0.5%. Delivering the annual Mansion House speech tonight, or last night, the governor said that growth had been faster than expected.
There's already great speculation about the exact timing of the first rate hike, and this decision is becoming more balanced. It could happen sooner than financial markets currently expect.
Well, our reporter Philip Hampshire spent the evening at Mansion House.
We have the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Mr. George Osborne, also the Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, give out different speeches for how they see the economy going, what they see as being particularly important for the business environment, and basically discussing things with some of the most important people in London and in the United Kingdom as a whole.
Now, Mark Carney's hinting at a rise in interest rates, isn't he? Why is that?
Well, there's a lot of concern that's been aired over the course of the day, but particularly based around these speeches. All of it has been pegged to George Osborne's speech about the housing market and the strength of the UK economy. And they have a very difficult task ahead of them, because obviously with the housing market roaring away, particularly down in the southeast of the UK, that's promoting a good amount of economic growth. At the same time that they've got that going on, unemployment hasn't been coming down quite as quickly as they've been looking for. So that Mark Carney has been holding off on raising interest rates, and basically this evening he's chosen to highlight the fact that he may have to put up interest rates a little bit quicker than everyone had previously been anticipating. In some senses, that may be a good thing. He's saying the economy is doing reasonably well.
What impact would a rise in interest rates have on ordinary people?
Well, the most prominent way that interest rates affect your average person in the street, of course, is if they've got a mortgage. Anyone who doesn't have a fixed-rate mortgage would then see Bank of England put up its rate. This would filter through to the banks. The banks would then put up their interest rates. And by far the biggest component that that would have for the average person is they'd have to start paying more every month for their mortgage. For other people, though, there are still impacts. If you're a saver, then you might actually be quite pleased about this. Savings rates have been really quite terrible for the majority of people over the last few years, and so they might actually see a little bit of a boost.
George Osborne also spoke tonight about fears of a bubble in the housing market. What did he have to say about that?
Well, essentially, London house prices have been rising very quickly, around about 17% in the course of the last year, and that's created a little bit of concern on several fronts. Firstly, the rest of the UK hasn't been growing anything like that quickly, and so people have been saying, is this a bubble? Now, in addition to that, in order to afford these houses that are getting ever more expensive, and flats, of course, in some cases have been getting ever more expensive, people have been having to borrow ever larger amounts from their banks. Whereas you might typically, 20 years ago, borrow 3.5 times your income, people have now been going to 5 and 6 times their income. And what he's announced today is that part of the Bank of England will be set up specifically to clamp down on large multiples being lent out to different people.
Well, that was Philip Hampshire at a very noisy mansion house. If you hadn't noticed, the World Cup is underway in Brazil. The opening ceremony was held yesterday evening in Sao Paulo, ahead of Brazil taking on Croatia in the first match. Here's Five Live's review of the night. Well, that's it, the World Cup. I hope you enjoy the next few weeks of football, and certainly should be watching as much of it as I can. Oh, look at the time, it's coming up to 5 o'clock.
First for breaking news and the best live sport. This is BBC Five Live.